Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 218. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me this week, John Lindemann.
Hide your kids, hide your wife.
On-call presentation there.
Indeed. Greg Leahy, of course.
Hello.
Greg Leahy, the Brett Favre of our podcast. He starts every game.
I'm the Brett Favre of the podcast.
That would be John with all the false retirements, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that is John is a far more approximate.
All right, so you're the Cal Ripken Jr.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah, well, James isn't here this week. He's actually at a football game, I believe.
I heard James actually got benched from this show for not having the cardiovascular endurance for it. Is that true?
It was amazing, too, after his four-interception game last week. It was pretty amazing.
I hope James actually listens to get that, Bob.
All right, so our special guest this week is Nathan Mustafa. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me on.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for doing this. So you might know Nathan's voice from the NWR newscast, where he has recently become a regular over there.
I've terrorized them for about 7 episodes, yeah.
Yeah, doing a great job. And of us here, only I got to meet Nathan very briefly at E3 before he was on the staff. You're back in the media room, right?
Yeah, back in the stupid press room.
So anyway, Nathan.
Yes?
What have you been playing lately? What have you been playing other than what you're reviewing? If we may differentiate from the newscast.
Oh, I was going to talk about Ben 10 Ultimate Alien Destruction and then...
Oh, that's okay. I don't want to hear about Oops Prank Party either. Although that was a pretty funny discussion on the last newscast.
I felt bad about that rant afterwards, but screw Hudson.
I enjoyed it.
No, I've been playing Super Meat Boy.
Okay, that's acceptable. So, Super Meat Boy, how awesome is it? So awesome.
It is so awesome.
I'm envious of you. For
I know you've already talked about it here, and I've actually only gotten about 2 worlds in, because I've been busy with other things. Mm-hmm. But God, it's so finely tuned. I was having a big problem with it until I switched to actually using the analog stick and got way easier. I don't know if you use a D-pad or not, but...
I usually use the D-pad until my thumb starts to hurt, and then I'll switch temporarily to the analog stick.
Yeah,
for the same reason, I'll flip back and forth between using the X button for run or the R trigger for run. That game is physically painful to play after a while because it's so intense. I mean, it will make you grip the controller just in its death vice.
Yeah. Leaned forward all the way on the couch, eyes just completely open.
Shoulders hunched forward and...
Yes, sweat.
Yes. For hours.
Yeah, I made the bad decision of buying that the day before a midterm, and it was just so freaking difficult to tear myself away. But, God, I love how difficult it is. And it's not unfair in any sense, because you always see what you're supposed to do.
It's evil, but it's not unfair.
It's evil, but it's misunderstood. No, yeah, I like it. Actually, I really like the warp zones. Those are probably my favorite part of the whole thing.
So, yeah, I haven't talked about that yet, but the warp zones are the sort of retro-flavored stages.
Right, you find them while you're playing through other levels. You see sort of a little cosmic disruption, and you jump into it, and yeah you're in a retro-styled level. Or a series of them, actually.
Yeah, they're always 3 in a row, and they're just as hard, if not more hard, than the other stages. They're usually a little bit simpler in design. Just less moving parts.
It's a little more difficult because it limits you with the amount of lives you can use. It's 3 per each phase of the warp zone.
Right, per level, yeah. And that's normally you always have unlimited.
Right, and then at the end you can just watch all of your, successive attempts run through the level at once. That is awesome.
Yeah, the warp zones are really cool. A few of them will let you play as a different character, and if you can beat the warp zone, you unlock that character, but there's only a few of those. Most of them are styled after various retro gaming systems. So some of them look like Game Boy games. There's one of the really cool ones looks like an Atari 2600 game. Very bright, sort of neon flashing oranges and purples. It's awesome.
The Game Boy one kind of threw me off because the resolution's so high. So it doesn't really feel like a Game Boy game because you're zoomed out so far. But at the same time, you could tell what they were going for.
It's totally, like, faded. It's not, like, super sharp black and white. It's more like grayscale.
Yeah, definitely. There's, like, that yellow tinge to everything.
Almost greenish, which... Yeah, it looks more like a Game Boy Pocket than an original Game Boy screen, because it is gray and not green.
Yeah.
And some of them look like Genesis, Super Nintendo. There's a lot of them that look like basically
love
NES.
The soundtracks in the... Yeah, in the warp zones, those are actually a little more evocative in the graphical style, because it's already kind of sparse in the main game.
Yeah, that was Nathan Fouts was sort of complaining about that. At first, I wasn't sure what he was referring to, and then I went back and played the game, and I think I get it because it might be that Super Meat Boy, I think, kind of started as a WiiWare project, and then eventually they decided to do an HD version, and then eventually that became the lead platform.
Right, and then now, obviously, the Wii version's getting screwed.
Well, it was kind of screwed from the start, and you've scratched the surface if you're only through two worlds, but...
Yeah, no, I played through the two worlds, and I played through the Dark World versions of both of them.
Okay.
Yeah, I like to go back and do that immediately.
Yeah, that's a better sampling than I expected, but... That game has about 300 or 400 levels in it.
Man.
And on the Xbox Live Arcade version, you can also download new worlds every now and then. They'll add a whole new world. And there's a world called the Internet, and it's basically like free. I think it's all going to be free DLC.
So they haven't added anything yet, right?
No, they have. Yeah.
Oh, really? Wow.
There's already like 20 more levels that you can download, and they're going to be adding more when they patch it. So there's a ton of content, and I'm not surprised it won't fit on WiiWare. I'm really not surprised at all.
Oh, yeah, it's not a surprise that it won't fit. It's just a shame that it can't.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I wish they could, you know, I wish Nintendo could issue them a waiver or something, but
right.
The thing is, a little birdie told me back at E3 that there is a very, in his words, a very good technical reason for that size limit on WiiWare. I might argue with the very good reason part of it, you know, it's probably just like shitty system architecture.
But it makes it an intractable problem.
I think that's the case, yes.
Probably the same reason we couldn't play Brawl online, you know. Everything was shit from the get-go, so now you're screwed.
But yeah, I think if they could raise the limit, they probably would.
How would you feel about how they suggested on their Twitter going for like a $20 sort of extended retail version?
I think that would be better. Because, let me tell you, I've played 10, 12 hours at least of Super Meat Boy, and I'm not nearly finished with it. I think this game is easily worth $20. It's easily worth $50 as far as I'm concerned. I mean, for the people who are going to like this kind of game anyway, there's so much of it, and it's so good that the price is really no object as far as I'm concerned. I think they should absolutely slap it on a disc for Wii.
And really, if you're going to play it by yourself, you're going to get the same sort of amount of experience as you would with New Super Mario Brothers anyways, I think. In a single-player experience?
It's comparable value.
Oh, I think Meat Boy is a much better value than New Super Mario Brothers Wii.
Really?
Much better, yes. There is a lot more content.
Well, I think it could do with co-op.
It's a lot more satisfying. You know, the way these levels are engineered and balanced, just down to the pixel, I think throwing another character in there would just drive it crazy. I mean, it would just be so chaotic. It wouldn't be fun, I don't think. But who knows, maybe they'll try that one day.
Well, N Plus managed to do it, and it was actually very similar to Super Meat Boy.
Yeah, that kind of makes me want to go back and play... N Plus. I think I tried a demo of it a long time ago, and
you should really try it.
It didn't catch with me, but the physics of it were really strange and...
Mm-hmm. A lot more floaty.
Yeah, so there's something about it.
It felt a little bit more sluggish than Super Meat Boy, that's certain.
Oh, Super Meat Boy is breakneck. It's so fast. Everything about it. I mean, the character moves really fast, the levels move really fast, but also just the pacing of it, because you die, and within half a second... You're reborn and you're playing again. And so it just never lets up. It doesn't even give you a chance to stop playing.
Have you sat there and watched all the dead Super Meat Boys run through after you successfully complete the level?
Occasionally, yeah.
I love that.
I don't do it every time, but it's an awesome feature.
Yeah, I think it's incredible.
There are so many amazing Nintendo tributes in this game that it's weird to play it on Xbox. I mean, it's not a problem. But it's weird because it is so blatantly, just slavishly adoring of of old Nintendo games, of not necessarily of Nintendo's own games. There's tons of Contra and Mega Man references and stuff like that. It's just drowning in stuff like that. And, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people who enjoyed those games who now have Xboxes, so maybe it's not so weird to them, but it's weird to me.
Right.
And then the final level, at least in the light world, I'm not going to spoil it, but there is a blatant and awesome reference to Mario.
I don't know what it is, but I really hope that it's you're running at whatever boss it is and you jump over his head and land on the thing at the end of the bridge and it kills him.
No comment. It is amazing, though. It's really amazing.
Okay.
I recommend everybody play it, whether you do it on your Xbox or wait until the WiiWare version, whenever that comes out, you will be happy. If you like ridiculously hard platforms. I mean, it's like the death metal of platformers, right?
I guess.
So, we've probably fawned over that enough. So tell us about the new Fallout.
Not as much fawning here. I don't know why I got it, really. I played quite a bit of Fallout 3 and sort of concluded that there was a lot about it that bothered me. And I guess I was hoping that they'd fix some of it, but really they haven't fixed all that much. I still like the story and sort of the ludicrous nature of the combat, you know, things blowing up and just the stupid facial expressions on your horribly designed characters. But really the biggest thing that bugs me about it is just the way the combat works is that if you don't want to use the VATS or if you run out of, and VATS is the sort of turn-based combat system that they built into the game, or if you run out of action points, you're forced to just sort of back up eternally as the enemy chases you, because there's almost no enemy AI. The only thing they do is chase. So any encounter that you're not strong enough to kill them before they close that gap, and if you're not good at melee, you end up just running back in a line for, you know, however long you last until they're dead. And that gets very, very old, especially when, you know, you're in tight corridors and you're having to hop through doors and figure out a whole new room that the enemies are going to now chase you mindlessly through. That gets old after about 40 hours of that. But eventually you can just break the game and not have to worry about it and blow everything up that way.
Which one do you prefer, Fallout 3 or New Vegas?
I like New Vegas a little better because it feels a little more dense. I think Fallout 3 went a little overboard with the wasteland motif. I understand why they did it, but when you can run through 10 minutes of game and not have any content or anything or see anything interesting. You know, in Oblivion, there was sort of that problem, but you could see interesting things and feel like you were exploring. It's almost like hiking. But in New Vegas, it's just, or in Fallout 3, it's just, you know, you're running through a dead world, and maybe a feral dog will come up and attack you.
And that's all.
How stimulating.
And that's it.
Sounds shitty.
Yeah, and then...
But it's the game of the year, Johnny.
Well, John, did you ever play Fallout 3?
No. I never played it.
It seems like something you might try out, you know?
Yeah, I kind of had the experience with Oblivion where it sounded good in theory, but I just didn't... It's hard for me to kind of sink that much time into a strictly single-player game, or like especially with an RPG.
Can I play the role of James and ask the more pertinent question of whether he bought Fallout 3?
I did actually buy it. Actually, that's one of those things. It's one of those...
Yes!
It's one of those... Let me defend myself here. It's actually a bullet that I dodged because once I got it, of course, me being me, I bought the ridiculous. I bought the version from Amazon where you got the clock.
Oh, you really have descended into self-parody.
No, but wait. It actually worked out. Everything worked out in the end because the clock was actually defective, so I was able to return the entire thing. And so I never got it again. So it's beautiful.
Oh, man. I actually didn't buy Fallout 3. I won it in a GameSpot contest, and I didn't feel that bad about that. I'm kind of regretting New Vegas, because I know I'm going to get tired of all the things that bothered me in Fallout 3 very soon. But it is fun. It's a little... the story itself, it can be entertaining, which is, I guess, a primary draw for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I am tempted to try one of these games, but... I don't really think I'll like it, but you never know until you try it.
Yeah.
I'm just generally not really into the whole Western style RPG thing. Mass Effect is the
here pick exactly what you want your character to be with no reference towards what it's going to end up being like.
Oh, I hate that. I've talked about that before.
Yeah, I know you have, and it bugs me too in stuff like this, because there's no, like, trial. Like, you don't run through an opening section with all the powers, and you get to see, like, oh, this is awesome. I want to put points into this. It's just, you start. And it's, so do you want to be good at science? Well, I don't know. I've never played your game,
yep.
But it definitely does that. And it does a little better job of guiding you this time through the opening sequence. And you don't have to play through the whole, you're a baby. literally, you started out as a baby in Fallout 3, and that is just horrible.
Well, maybe I'll try it soon. Of course, you are playing plenty of Nintendo games, but they're all shitty, and you're reviewing them. And we talked about them on the other podcast.
I'm stuck in Ben 10. I haven't talked about it. I'm stuck within the first 5 minutes. I have to get over a step or something, and I can't. I played 20 minutes of trying to get over the step, and I turned the thing off.
I kind of doubt it will be the ultimate game in that franchise.
Probably not.
let's hope it's the ultimate.
One of the things about video games is the words ultimate and final never mean anything.
Yeah.
Well.
All right. So, Greg, you're up next.
Yeah, tough week. Still no Kirby. He still hasn't made his journey to our fair shores. Getting a little worried that it's going to show up at all. I don't know whether I've got the fortitude to order another import copy. So right now we're kind of pitting the ineptitude of the Postal Service against Nintendo of Europe for when I'm going to actually get to play.
Those are two titans of ineptitude battling it out.
It's an epic battle. It's like, you know, Lister Ali or something. But we'll see. I hope to talk about it next week, but I'm not going to make any promises in that regard. So I did finish getting all the treasures in Wario Land Shake It. So Wario's little hideaway is all nicely decked out in gold now.
You S-ranked that bitch.
No, it's not S-ranked, because those missions, like, I've only got 50%. So
oh, you'll never get all those.
It's a sort of lesser tier of completionist sort of thing.
Still pretty good, though. I mean, that's tough. Some of those are pretty challenging.
Yeah, oh yeah. Definitely my favorite stuff in the game, some of those ones. So, yeah, I was happy to put that to bed, like, 2 years later after I first got it, I think.
It's my style. I'm proud of you, Greg.
I've been playing this week. There's a demo of the DS version of Sonic Colors available on Japan and Europe's Nintendo channels.
And America.
And so I thought I'd try it out, because I had Sonic Rush 5 years ago now. That really is kind of scary that it was that long. That kind of sneaks up on you. That was the last Sonic game I had. It's only the second Sonic game I've ever played after the original one for Genesis. And it's probably the only one I've ever really enjoyed by elimination there. So I thought I'd give this a go just because I did enjoy the original Sonic Rush, skipped over Adventure, which was pretty soon after, and it didn't seem like it added a great deal. But this is a bit strange because it is a Sonic Colors game, but it's clearly got a hell of a lot of common with Rush. It does seem to be kind of just a Rush sequel with some of the sort of thematic elements that are going to be in the new Wii game, from what I played of it. I mean, the one stage, it was only sort of one stage, so it's not a huge demo by any means. But from that stage, the main differences you could detect from Rush is, first of all, you haven't got any of the sort of trick stuff to build up that tension kind of dash gauge anymore. You accumulate that from collecting the standard wisps or whatever these creatures that are in it now, like the colourless ones. And then you can use that gauge when you collect the coloured wisps that actually give you like power-ups. And in the demo, you've got this red one that kind of turns Sonic into a fireball, and you can charge it up and just propel him into the air in pretty much any direction. It really sort of liberalizes his movement. And then just playing the stage a couple of times, you can find like a lot more red wisps if you keep going higher and higher and higher, and you can keep replenishing that gauge and find what seemed to be a completely different kind of exit to the level. Now, because it didn't go anywhere, obviously, because it's just the end of the demo, I don't know what kind of significance that's going to have in the sort of broader game, but that could be interesting, because I understand from the preview coverage that I've read that using the wisp powers is never essential for just clearing a level.
It's always like for secret stuff.
Yeah, but I guess the question is going to be, how rewarding is that going to be? You know, is it going to be like whole other levels that it could take you to or something? I don't know at this point, obviously, but that struck me as quite interesting. And definitely the Sonic Rush Foundation is very solid. You know, it looks nice, it runs well, and it wasn't perfect in its level design. There were still some sort of irksome places in the original I wasn't that fond of, but Dimps, I think, you know, have got a pretty solid kind of reputation with their work on the Advance games and the Rush game, so it seems like, you know, it could be a nice Sonic game, but you do have to worry about its fate when it's going up against the Wii version of the same name, which has got positive early reviews in the magazines.
I saw that today, yeah.
Yeah, Nintendo Power gave a good review of the States. There's a lot of European magazines that have given it good reviews. My intuition and experience tells me that subsequent reviews will not be as positive. But it still may be pretty damn good. So it's going up against that. And then it's going up against Sonic 4 for the downloadable platforms.
Have you played the demo of that, Greg?
I have not played any of Sonic 4.
It's not very good.
It'll make you feel better about colors if you go play it.
I was going to say, I mean, Dimps worked on Sonic 4 too. I don't know if they did all the development on it or just part of it, but
whoever came up with the lock-on mechanic should be out.
Well, that's in Sonic Colors, but I think I think that and everything else feels better in Sonic Colors on the DS, because I played the demo today as well, and I think it's the same demo that I played back at E3.
Yeah, I think it might even just be a section of that demo. I don't think it's as big as probably the E3 one, to be honest.
But I still think it feels really good. I feel like it's probably the first time I've really enjoyed Sonic.
I remember enjoying the E3 demo, but I don't remember the lock-on in that, probably because I didn't find the button or something.
It's in there, but you don't need it as much, for one thing, because you have that horizontal boost that you can do.
Right.
And then you also have the downward stomp.
Yeah.
And then you got the wisps too, the red thing where you turn into the fireball. So you can go through, you end up using it a lot less than you do in that Sonic 4 demo.
Yeah, I enjoyed the Colors demo. Sonic 4 just felt so cynical.
Yeah, I also think there's a huge difference in level design quality. Because in the Sonic Colors demo, there aren't hidden spikes, there aren't bottomless pits at the bottom of
it doesn't
arc.
Count on the player being psychic.
No, exactly, and that's exactly how I felt about Sonic 4.
Well, that's why I was kind of wondering whether that's maybe how they're going to try and wrangle things this time, is in terms of the level being more taxing, it could be like reaching some of these hidden things with the wisps or something, whereas just the kind of bog standard run through could be a bit easier than it was in Sonic Rush, because there was definitely some towards the end, there was some really quite hard stuff in that, and you know, plenty of spikes, and you know, not to me as an irritating as the first one was back on Genesis, but there was still some of that in there, so it could be one way of partitioning the two sort of gameplay styles a little bit. But I just think it's a distinct possibility that if this is, you know, a very, very sort of solid addition to Sonic's portable legacy, it could just get horrendously overlooked. I mean, if you want to add in, you know, Nintendo's own side-scrollers on platforms as well, you know, people have got a lot of options for side-scrolling action at the minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think, I mean, it helps that it's on the DS. If we're talking about the DS version specifically, I think it'll probably be okay because Sonic's fan base is still mostly on the DS, more than any other platform. And there aren't that many good new 2D platformers this year for DS. You know, I guess the main issue would be piracy, which is a big thing for any third-party DS game right now. But I think Sonic Colors stands to do better than most. Mm. And it helps that it seems from the demo to be actually, like, really, really good. I'm shocked that I enjoy it. And I enjoyed it just as much playing it today as I did a few months ago at E3. And, I mean, I can foresee the possibility of me actually buying a Sonic game, which is, I can't tell you when the last time that was. It had to have been on Genesis.
Really?
I downloaded Sonic, I got Sonic 3 on Virtual Console, but it wasn't as good as I remembered.
You didn't get any of the DS games?
None of the GBA games, no.
The last Sonic game that I got was the Battle Arena one on the GBA. It was like a top-down multiplayer brawler. It was like an isometric Super Smash Brothers with Sonic.
Are you sure this actually existed?
No. I was at a young age before alcohol was a thing. This is real.
You needed some other kind of drug?
And I was too old to be imagining it, so... The worst part, I enjoyed it.
I'm glad you're all grown up now.
Yeah.
All right, so Sonic Colors might be good. John, I know you haven't had much time with the new job to play much, so if you don't have any games to talk about this week, I was wondering if maybe you could just give us your wish list. Like, what do you wish you were playing right now?
What do I wish I was playing right now? Well, see, one of the big obstacles, right? I want to get Rock Band 3, but I, for some reason, these are the kind of ridiculous things that happen when you move. I had my setup here at home. I have one monitor, and I run my PC, my PS3, my 360 through that. And it all goes through an HDMI switch. Well, somehow, I think that I plugged my HDMI switch into the wrong AC unit and fried it, so it's now destroyed. And on top of that, I can no longer find... I can't figure out how to hook up my monitor anymore, is really what it comes down to.
And I'd like to again interject as James and make a senility reference.
It's good to know that none of us are ever actually absent on this show.
Oh yes, well, I could capably perform as any of us, apart from maybe myself.
So anyways, yeah, so my PS3 and my 360 are plugged in, but they're just staring at me because they have no monitor to hook up to, and I don't believe this guy has any HDMI inputs. So that's where I'm at, but I would be playing Rock Band 3 if I could.
With the keytar? You seem like a keytar man to me.
I am actually a keytar man. Yes, indeed. And I would probably put on white gloves to play the keytar with. In true 80s style.
You know, they've got Snoop Dogg's Sensual Seduction as DLC now.
Wait, that's a real thing? Like,
oh,
someone
yes,
named
yes.
a song that?
Yes, it's the one where he sings through an auto-tuner, and the video is hilarious. It's like straight out of, I don't know, 78? Or something. It's wow. Really strange, like retro video where he's playing a keytar in the video, and it's all like psychedelic background stuff. It's really, really strange.
The only
it's
thing awesome. I know about Snoop Dogg is that he lives by where I used to work.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Good old Snoop. But I can't believe Snoop plays a keytar, but that's awesome.
I don't know that he actually does.
Simulated.
Air keytaring.
It's been long known that the keytar is the instrument of pimps everywhere.
Well, the sad thing is that DLC came out right before Rock Band 3, so it doesn't have keyboard support in it. Now, you could still use the keytar mm-hmm. controller to play like the guitar or the bass line. But I'm hoping that'll be one of the songs that they're going to go back and patch in keyboard, because they've talked about doing that with certain select songs.
Well, I mean, it sounds like it needs it, if only to reenact the video.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
It does.
But, yeah, other stuff I would probably like to play, since I just beat the other PSP God of War title, I wouldn't mind playing
Ghost of Sparta.
But I have a hard time. I know it's actually on PSN now, but I have a hard time paying the $40 they're going to want for that game.
Oh, God. Especially when you compare that to the price of, like, the God of War collection.
Yeah. Which, you actually, know. I think that just went up on PSN, too.
Yeah, it's downloadable now.
But, yeah, so I'll probably wait and just get that guy when it's, you know, in 3 weeks when it's $10 at Toys R Us or something.
Physical media depreciation.
It's with PSP stuff, it is. It's immediate. You know, I keep waiting for something good. Super Meat Boy, of course. Goes without saying.
I think, yeah, you'd like it.
Yeah, I think I would, too. You know, I keep waiting for something good to come out on Virtual Console, but it just doesn't really seem to happen. You know, even though, what is it, Super Slam? Super Slam came out this week?
Yes, the Neo Geo basketball.
Yes, as tempting as that is, you know, you wave that out of my nose.
Hey,
might
it's
just...
a game, John. Don't let the gift those in the mail.
So you weren't interested in Mystic Quest then?
No, I was not interested in Mystic Quest.
I have a soft spot for Mystic Quest. I'm not going to tell you it's a good game and you should go out and download it, but if I downloaded it, I would probably enjoy it.
Why, did you play it as a kid?
Oh yeah, multiple times. Yes.
Yeah.
It's pretty slow in Japan right now, even for Virtual Console stuff, although there is an N64 game that just came out, but it's Mario Party 2.
Yeah. Some people think that's the best one. So
I assume that's why they've done that rather than the original, or, you know, they've gone straight to 2.
I think the original's out.
Nah. Not in Japan, at least. Because huh. I'm intimately familiar with the Wikipedia list for Japan's Virtual Console.
All right.
The rest of the month is kind of slow, apart from Ghosts and Goblins Arcade. So
yeah.
If I can't have Super Meat Boy kick me in the nuts, maybe I'll go.
I wonder if the 3DS is just going to stop any chance we have of getting those last N64 games in, like, Pilot Wings.
Yeah, I mean, why sell them for $10 when you can sell them for $40?
Mm-hmm. Right.
At least might have to wait until that phase plays itself out, and then you're talking about a probably Wii successor virtual console. And
right. Yeah. We're going to start overlapping online stores for these systems, for sure. Yeah.
Well, it's okay. I mean, it's okay that there's anything coming out on VC, because I'm pretty much covered, because I still have, you know, Enjoy Your Massage to tide me over until something else comes out.
Are you
on
doing
VC.
The second quest on that now?
Yeah, he just had to put in his name as Zelda.
Yeah.
You get to start the new game plus with all your calluses already.
John, have you started, have you heard much about DJ Hero 2?
Well, I read Neil's review, which is on the site, NintendoWorldReport.com, but I'm kind of hesitant about it. It looks like I would probably play it and just be like, yep, this is a lot like the original with a couple more tweaks, and I'm tempted. There's actually some songs on there that I'd be interested in playing through, but I'm kind of holding off. That's another one of those things. That franchise is weird, because I hesitant to kind of jump in, because I know that that's another game that's just going to drop in price, because it just seems like it has like kind of a hardcore fan base.
But you've still got a controller, right, from the first DJ Hero?
Yeah, and I don't believe they've changed anything.
No, the controller is exactly the same.
Yeah.
I don't know if you actually care, but I kind of want you to get Def Jam Rapstar and videos and show them to us.
For sure.
He's turning you into a dancing bear. Don't do it. don't listen to it.
Yeah, I've read good things. Actually, I was reading a rap magazine. Go figure.
So could we have a redux of our last week's print discussion, but talking about the medium of rap?
They had an article, and it was about Def Jam Rapstar, and it was being played by like
Hulk Hogan.
No, it was not. It was not Hulk.
Oh, that video is amazing.
I haven't watched that yet. I had to save it.
When the flashing commence.
I can't.
Oh. It is soul crushing.
What has happened to Hulk Hogan? I mean, he's like doing like Rent-A-Center ads. Oh.
So, all right, John. Well, those are the games that you wish you were playing.
I wish I was playing.
Is your wife still playing Mario Kart Wii?
Well, I mean, it's still going, but we've kind of cooled off on that just because we really haven't been around. We moved, and then it's just been really hectic since then. So,
you guys might enjoy Kirby as a couples activity.
Yeah, that's another one, actually, that I wish I was playing since, you know, it just came out, and everybody seems to absolutely just love it.
Yeah, so I'll go next, and I'll start with Kirby. I'm not finished with it yet, but I'm getting near the end. I got to Space Land, which is pretty awesome, you know. And I still really like Kirby a lot. I honestly put it down for several days and just got embroiled in other games.
Flogged by Meat Boy.
Yeah, Meat Boy and Alan Wake and other stuff, but Bit Trip. But, you know, Kirby, I would tell people, if you've started playing it and you've gotten maybe a little bored or a little mired in the early stuff, because it starts off so easy that it's just not all that engaging. Like, because the charm factor, I think, can wear off. Certainly, it stays charming throughout the game, and it's always showing you interesting new things in terms of presentation, but the novelty of that can wear off, and it really has to survive on the merits of the gameplay. And in the first half of the game, there's a point where the charm was starting to lose its must-play value for me, and the gameplay hadn't yet geared up, and that was a lull for me. And I pushed through that, and the stages and the gameplay start to get more interesting from that point, and they start to make up the deficit in my attention that, you know, that the presentation had lost over time. The levels start to get a little more challenging. There will be times when you miss things and you have to go back through it. And that could sound tedious, but it's not. It's actually kind of a joy to play through these levels multiple times, because you will see things you didn't see before, and it'll make you appreciate things that you might have just glanced over the first time. And good feel, as you might expect from Wario Land Shake It. They do a great job of offering up little pieces of gameplay that are really unique to every level. There's things that you won't do in any other level. Some of the transformations in particular, they do pretty interesting things with them. Although they seem very simple. I mean, there's one where you turn into a dolphin, and all it can do is just charge. It has a charge move like Echo, and that's all it does. You know, you can jump out of the water with that, and he'll do a little flip in the air that doesn't do anything. And that's about it. But the way they mix that in with the level design is really clever. I played a level yesterday in which there are bubbles of water floating in the air that you have to jump into. It's very similar to DK Jungle Beat. You know, the places where there's like cubes of water floating in space.
Yeah, they do that in one of the, I think it's one of the secret levels, is it, in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, where you've got the giant like bubbles of water suspended in midair as well?
I don't know if I've played that one. There's a bit of it in Galaxy 2 as well.
Oh, definitely Galaxy 2, yeah.
Which is, of course, you know, the guys who made Jungle Beat. But yeah, there's some of that in Kirby, and of course it's all 2D, and the really funny thing about it is that the way the level is constructed of materials, this bubble of water that you have to jump into and that, you know, suspends you in air and lets you get to higher places with this, in this dolphin form, it's not, there's not even anything in it. It's literally a circle of blue yarn. Yeah. And the background is just the background that would be there anyway. So there's almost a little bit of visual acuity testing going on here, because at first glance, you might not even realize which parts of the level are water and which ones aren't. So you have to almost like focus your eyes in such a way that you can tell what you can swim through and what you can't. It's pretty neat. And later on, those bubbles of water start to move on tracks back and forth. So yeah, there's some timing that gets mixed into it. It ends up being a really interesting level. I think it's one of the secret ones, but it's great. Hmm.
In old Kirby games, the transformations were managed by absorbing the enemies. How does it work in this one?
In this one, you pull a patch off the wall and you jump into a little swirly thing.
Is it like until you get hit, or is it just...
No. It's for a certain amount of the level. Sometimes it's virtually the entire level. Sometimes it's just a segment. You play up to a point, and then there's like this vertical wooden pole. And as you pass that, it's like a goalpost, basically. And as you pass that, Kirby unspools back into his normal form.
Okay.
So it's all scripted.
Yeah, I mean, it's just basically the transformations are unlimited. You can play around with them as much as you want, but you get to a certain point in the level, and it's no longer allowed after that. And oftentimes, that is basically the end of the level. There's never any pressure. You never really feel like there's a timer, although there are a few levels that are scrolling. And those, you can definitely miss things the first time through. But the nice thing is those levels also tend to be pretty fast. I played a level today that I must have beaten in less than 2 minutes. And, it was really fun. Really fun. So I didn't mind at all. But, yeah, these levels are sometimes quite short, but those are also the levels that you're most likely to need to play through again and take a different path. And that's perfectly fine. You know, that level was kind of a little bit like a Donkey Kong minecart level, but much easier. But it's a similar idea where you're kind of like on a surfboard and you're like jumping off of enemies' heads to get arcs of beads. It's really cool. So that game continues to delight. I'm actually liking it more now than I was before because it's ramped up. You know, it's coming up closer to my level of ability and to my specific interest in gameplay terms.
Do you think it's getting to the point where people that may have, you know, casually picked it up would have to stop and put it down?
No, I don't think it's going to impede anyone's progress, but they're going to start getting less and less of the treasures and medals.
Okay.
And they, you know, they might not ever see any of the secret stages anyway. Those are pretty tricky to get. You have to fight the bosses in a very specific way, and each one of them is different. So that actually takes a little bit of thought. It ends up, the bosses otherwise would be really easy, because you can't die, so eventually you will kill the boss, right? There's only one possible outcome in a boss fight when you can't die. So you lock me in a room with this octopus thing, and it might take me 20 minutes, but I'm going to kill it. So
sounds like an awesome movie.
It's probably been done. But they take that opportunity to actually provide some really challenging strategies to get the patch for the secret level. So you end up having to play it almost pristinely where you never get hit, or you have to do something kind of extra to hurt the enemy and make more beads come out rather than just kill it right off the bat. So those parts can be quite challenging, but of course that outcome of getting the patch is completely optional, so certainly not going to stop anybody. Let me put it this way. If you don't complete this game, you just aren't bothered. You know, like you're just not, you just haven't put enough time into it.
Oh, that's good, because it means it's a viable co-op experience in my house.
Yes.
Otherwise, you know, every one of my family members will just run straight into Koopas without without thought.
You might want to let them play with each other, Nathan, rather than, yeah, I mean...
Well, okay, say if I'm playing with my girlfriend, could she just hang in the back, and if it's the level scrolling, will it just drag her along?
Yeah, oh, that's I think
good.
So.
That's
yeah.
good.
I mean, she'll probably end up falling into pits and stuff, which means she's going to lose beads, which means you lose beads, because you share the same score.
I'm beyond caring about that, so...
Okay, if fine. You don't care about the score... Co-op will be no problem. You might get frustrated with her, but...
It is normal to go through a level in World 1 of New Super Mario Brothers and have continues used in
okay.
a level.
Well, then this is actually a much better option for you then.
Do you think the cuteness might be kind of, like, off-putting to someone that's not already predisposed to, like, Nintendo stuff?
No, I don't think so.
Because I know that we all already like Kirby, you know, at some level. And, you know, we don't question that. But then I'm just wondering if someone else sees this, you know, like another adult, it probably would just look like a baby game.
It's a good point.
And I would probably feel a little bit like a creep.
Yeah, somehow I think that the people I know that only play Modern Warfare 2 probably aren't checking for Kirby.
But, you know, they'd probably enjoy it if they actually did try it.
Yeah, but you know it's not going to happen.
Yeah, they're
right,
not going
to
try it.
I think what I'll do is I will just say that I will lie and say I have to review it. I need your help. So that way if they're like, why are you playing this baby game? I go, well, got to review it for that Nintendo thing.
I bet she'll enjoy it.
Kirby shame.
All right, the next game I'll talk about is Picross 3D. This motherfucker.
Still.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
It never ends.
I'm over 370 puzzles, which is 99% of the game, outside of the internet ones, which I don't think I'm going to bother with. Because the internet puzzles are kind of like randomly... They're kind of like a random distribution in terms of difficulty. Mm. Because they're outside of that tiered structure that you normally get, I kind of don't care, I think.
I'll give you 2 months. 2 months, you junkie.
I do feel like a junkie. I really
do. No, I can quit whenever I want.
Yeah, I do.
You sort of relapsed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I put this game in order to break my Dragon Quest IX addiction, which is kind of like taking heroin to cure morphine.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which is what heroin was invented for, was to cure morphine addiction.
What do you find the payoff is in this game? Because, like, I never found it that appealing, like, constructing a... Like what looks like a Minecraft dog or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's a good comparison. You know, honestly, creating these objects has nothing to do with it.
No,
it's just the thrill of the hunt.
I think the appeal for me is two things. First off, I like the structure of it. I like how it gives you this, you know, these 8 or 10 puzzles, and you know, you get stars based on how well you do, and then you need a certain number of those stars to unlock extra puzzles. That's a big incentive for me. In terms of like wanting to complete it, wanting to do every puzzle to get that medal that says I did all the puzzles. That's a big incentive. And then also while you're playing the game, I think it's the feel. It's not so much the sound, because I usually play with the sound off, but it's the feel and the visual look of breaking those blocks. I know that sounds silly.
No, that makes sense.
It makes it so much more appealing than 2D Picross, where you don't really get that.
You just mark things.
Yeah, you're just marking out. It's like a crossword puzzle. 3D Picross, you are chiseling away, and there's something weirdly psychologically satisfying about breaking all these blocks to uncover whatever's underneath, and I don't care what's underneath.
I think it says a lot about your childhood, Johnny.
I want to break the right
blocks. I blame it on your parents.
The thing that kept me playing through a lot of levels in Braid was the sound of the piranha plants. So I kind of get that. I just found that sound to be very satisfying.
Oh, yeah. Sound design is really overlooked in terms of its importance to making you feel satisfied when you do certain things in games.
Right. Oh, especially by the makers of Final Fantasy. God, the menu noises.
So, yeah, Picross 3D, if you haven't already started playing this game, don't. It's an addiction that you cannot afford. Not that it's expensive, but just in terms of time, oh my god. So, I've been playing, man, nothing really new this week, but I've just been playing so much of other stuff that I started earlier and have been going back to, just bits and pieces of so much crazy stuff. I bought, I've been playing more Rock Band 3. Still nothing interesting to say about it. I downloaded Costume Quest, which seems fun, but I've only just played the very beginning of it, so maybe I'll talk about that next time. The last thing that I'll wrap up with here is that I didn't think I would, but I ended up finishing Alan Wake. You know, I wasn't that hot on it last week, and I wouldn't take away anything that I said last week about it. I mean, I still agree with all the statements I made, and I can't tell you exactly why I've decided to finish it. And the best I can come up with is maybe just that I knew it was a pretty short game and I must have been, you know, halfway through it at least. And I felt kind of silly returning it to Gamefly when I could spend 2 more hours and beat it. And I was enjoying it reasonably, you know, it just wasn't mind-blowing or anything. Mm-hmm. So I just went ahead and finished it up. And it actually ended up being a little longer than I expected. I'd say it probably comes in around, I don't know, 7 or 8 hours in all. So I wasn't as far along as I thought, but the gameplay definitely never evolves very much, and I think that's ultimately my main criticism of it. The story never makes any more sense. It goes through a period where you think it might actually make sense, and it's all going to come out sort of reasonable in the end, and then it just dives headfirst back into crazy land. Have you played this, Nathan?
Yeah, I actually barreled through it in a one-day rental.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I could see people doing that, yeah.
God, the final battle. What was that?
Okay, so I wanted to bring this up because, and it's too bad James isn't here. Spoilers, if you're still, for some reason, playing through Alan Wake and you haven't gotten to the end, I'm going to spoil it a little bit, and it's worth it, because the final boss... you fight a tornado and you kill it by shooting it with a gun. So,
oh my god, James, yeah, I would love that.
It is disaster day of crisis.
James has got fourth dimensional powers of prescience.
I know.
He is with us.
I mean, it tornado. Is ludicrous, the final it battle. Is,
and I remember it taking about, like, a minute, maybe, because it's I really, had saved yeah. up something. There was some. I don't remember that much of the
you
game.
You shoot it with a flare gun, which is kind of the rocket launcher.
I saved
launcher.
Up my flares, and I remember that just murdered it very quickly.
Well, they also give you a bunch of flares right before you get to it, so it's okay. It's more of an event than an actual battle.
Right.
But, I mean, you just run up to the edge of a cliff and launch about 5 flares into it, and it's done.
And you kill the darkness tornado.
It just looks so stupid. I mean, it's ridiculous. It also makes no fucking sense in the story.
It doesn't help that there's like a 5-minute run to the tornado, so you have time to let it dawn on you that you're running to fight a tornado.
Yeah.
You know, as you just venture towards it on that ridge.
Are you kidding? It's epic.
I mean, graphically, it looks amazing. And that's one of the strongest assets of the game, is the presentation is so good. And I think that's one of the main reasons that I kept playing, is that I was just continually amazed at the aesthetic of it, because I do like the setting in the Pacific Northwest, and it's certainly a very strong, cohesive aesthetic. I mean, you never go out of that, really. But they do take you to different places within that look a little different. There's parts where you play through the town.
I really like the part in the lodge. I loved how that whole place was designed.
You go to a power plant later, and that's a pretty cool area. So there are a lot of interesting locations that they provide, and they all look really good. And I think the central graphical effect of it starts to look like you're hallucinating a little bit, and it's nightmarish. There's a lot of, I meant to say this last week, but there's a lot of Silent Hill Shattered Memories in this game, especially in the fact that when it's daylight outside, there's really no danger. So there are sections of the game, they're not too long, but there's sections of the game where you're kind of just exploring and talking to people or maybe just going from one place to another, and there are no enemies, there's no combat. And that's very similar to Shattered Memories. And then when you go into the darkness, the visual effect of that is really great. And you know when enemies are around, because the screen, I mean, it looks kind of distorted, and there's a really, really heavy dark fog everywhere. You can't see very well. I realized something late in the game, that if it didn't have that radar thing that pointed you to the next objective, the game would be completely unplayable.
Oh yeah, you would have no idea what you were doing.
No. Most of the environments are so dark and so, I mean, a lot of times you're just running through the woods, you don't even have a path. I don't know how this character is meant to be understanding where he's supposed to go, because there's no visual indication whatsoever.
He just follows the scattered coffee thermoses. glinting in the Energizer batteries.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's some pretty horrible product placement.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, in the end, it's a pretty good game. I'm glad I played it, but that ending is so funny.
Yeah, I would say I definitely enjoyed it, but the end was so stupid. And really, it never felt like it made less sense after the ending.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, the ending literally ends with an ellipsis. I mean, on the screen, you see a dot, dot, dot. That's the ending. It's, oh, my God, it's so stupid.
Yeah.
All right, that's the end of Alan Wake. You'll never hear me bring it up again. But we're going to take a much-needed break, and when we come back, we're actually going to talk about some GoldenEye. Not the new one, the old one.
Oh, yeah.
In celebration of the new one, which I actually will be getting next week. I ordered it. So none of us had it yet as of this recording. It just came out. But the next time you hear from me, at least, I'll be talking about GoldenEye for sure. And when we come back, we'll be talking about GoldenEye for the N64. Also, your listener mail. So stick around. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Well, this week we've got a blog post from Pedro about the Club Nintendo Mario fan and posters. These are the prizes for platinum level and gold level members of Club Nintendo. And we've got an unboxing from Pedro with all kinds of photos of the prizes.
In our review slate this week, we begin with Neil's take on Fling Smash, the Wii Motion Plus exclusive. In short, it has terrible controls, it is very short, and he hated it.
It's 10 bucks, though. I mean, it's kind of like Wii Play, like it's tempting, because it comes with a controller with the Remote Plus, so it's like, is it $10 good? Is it $10 bad? I don't know.
And next up, we have Matt Blunden's review of Pokemon Ranger Guardian Signs. It's okay, but doesn't hold a candle to the regular Pokemon games.
Next up in reviews, we have the review for FIFA Soccer Wii by James Charlton. He likes the tight controls, but is disappointed with the lack of online. And then we have Neil's review of Rock Band 3 for the DS, and he says it's good for fans of frequency and amplitude.
Yeah, with FIFA, James, I mean, he actually had some pretty good things to say about that game. He said it was really, really solid, really liked the controls. Actually, I think he actually liked it more than Pro Evolution Soccer. All right, and some more reviews. Lots of reviews this week, obviously. The avalanche is coming. Scooby-Doo and the Spooky Swamp for DS by Neil. He says the pacing is kind of poor. There's actually some load screens that pop up for every single puzzle you have to solve. But overall, the game's fairly fun, but he said that you may want to stick to the Wii version because I guess the games are very similar, and the Wii version has co-op, which makes it superior. Also, Zach has a review of Ben 10 Ultimate Alien Cosmic Destruction. I don't know how many more words you can fit in that title. He said it's overall, it's a quality platformer brawler mix for the DS.
Be sure to check out all of this original content and much more with reviews coming in almost every day this fall season. It's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Okay, we are back, and before we jump into mail, I wanted to do kind of a mini retrospective on GoldenEye for N64 in celebration, of course, of the release of the Wii quote-unquote remake, which it's not really, but everybody seems to be using that term. So anyway, the new GoldenEye for Wii is out this week. People seem to be liking it quite a bit. I'm looking forward to playing it next week. So I thought it'd be a good time to go back and talk about the original, which we've never talked about really at any great length on this show. So maybe we'll even get James to check in on his thoughts with it when he comes back next week. But to start off, I wanted to kind of address the fact that GoldenEye, I certainly wouldn't say it was like the best console first-person shooter ever or anything like that. It was certainly the best that had come out up to that point in 1997. And for a lot of people, I think part of the reason that they have so much nostalgia for it is it was either the first-person shooter that they'd ever really played very much, or certainly the first one on a console using a controller. So I wanted to first survey you guys a little bit and find out sort of what was your experience level when you first played GoldenEye, and what was your sort of initial reaction to it?
Well, I mean, up to that point, the only place that I had really played first-person shooters was on PC. You know, like stuff like Doom and, you know, Quake and stuff like that. And GoldenEye was very different from that. But, man, I played the hell out of that game. And what I loved about it was the fact that it was extremely difficult. Like, I remember, I mean, rage-inducing, especially at the end when you're fighting Trevelyan, is it?
Trevelyan, yeah.
Yeah, up on the, what do they call it? The
Cradle.
Yes, the Cradle. And I remember, I mean, just controller throwing rage, just...
Well, is that bit where you come down onto that tiny little platform at the end?
Yes.
And it'd be quite easy to just, like, fall straight off before the what would be a sort of pretty perfunctory coup de grace. But you've just fallen off that. And no checkpoints.
Nope.
No nothing.
Nope.
Back to the start.
It's like, absolutely. I mean, you had to know every level backwards and forwards to beat it on the hardest difficulties. It was insane.
Well, the mission design was a little bit, not trial and error, but really persnickety about you had to do things in a certain way.
Yeah.
So I can see why that would be the case. And especially, did you ever try to go for the secret time? You know, like try to beat the time record to unlock the...
cheat codes.
Oh, the cheat codes, right.
Yeah, I did at least some of those.
Yeah, yeah, those were just brutally difficult to do.
Because, of course, the way GoldenEye was, because, you know, if you died, that was it, it would instill kind of conservatism in you. You know, well, it certainly did in me anyway. So I'd be very kind of careful. But, yeah, if you go for some of those times, that has to go out of the window a little bit.
Well, it was kind of tough but fair. Well, cruel but fair, really, because the thing is the guys would appear, like your enemies would appear in the same spot every time.
Yeah.
So you could literally sit there and just through trial and error learn the level cold. Now,
yeah.
Was that necessarily, you know, would that design work today? No, I don't think it would. But at the time, it was good. It was difficult, extremely difficult at times, but rewarding at the same time because you knew you could see that you could achieve mastery.
Well, and the thing was, in certain levels especially, if you were able to dispatch with the enemies in their sort of designated positions discreetly, you avoided the situation where you'd get a bunch of enemies coming in out of wherever because you made a bunch of noise or whatever.
Yeah.
Then it's all out of your control. It's all kind of chaotic. You can't necessarily just apply what you've learned from previous runs to that. Whereas, like, if you keep everything under control and tight and kill them in a very efficient manner, you know, headshots with the silenced PP7, then there was a nice sort of feeling that you were doing things right there because the stages were a lot quieter and a lot more clinical that way.
Yep.
I remember Perfect Dark using that a little more effectively. But GoldenEye does have alarms in the levels that the enemies can trigger, right?
Yes, yep. the physical alarm, like big red circles on the wall.
Yeah, so if you can kill him before he gets to that, then you can, you know, prevent all the other guys from flooding in.
And of course, you got the cameras, you know, if you're in view of them, that can just trigger an alarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a huge thing. The element of stealth, I don't think there'd ever been a first-person shooter with anything remotely like that before. And that was, I mean, this was before Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was really one of the first real stealth games at all. Certainly among the first that I ever played. And it was really wild because before this, and Nathan's being a little quiet, Nathan, how old were you in 97?
Well, I'm bad at subtraction. I never played the single player of GoldenEye. Ever.
It's too bad. It's worth playing, actually.
I was in like sixth grade or something when it came out, and I played the multiplayer probably about 3 to 4 times at a friend's house, maybe. I really remember really enjoying it, but yeah, you guys reflecting on the single player and comparing it to Perfect Dark, another game that I've never played. It has almost no meaning to me.
The single player is actually generally better than that of Perfect Dark, I would say.
Okay.
They got a little too cute with some of the missions in Perfect Dark, and the story elements are...
Oh, it's laughable. Terrible.
I don't know if it's unfortunate, but I guess the main shooter I played on the N64 was Jet Force Gemini.
Oh, that's a great shooter, though.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I remember being it fun and trippy, but I haven't played it in such a long time that I can't quite be sure.
Yeah, Jet Force Gemini is, I think, a little underappreciated in terms of its ancestry to a lot of the modern third-person shooters like Gears of War, for instance. There's a lot of that in Jet Force Gemini.
I remember, like, giant ants, and I think there were bears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, like, this is all from... I'm just a little bit younger than you guys, so, yeah.
A little bit, a lot younger than me, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
There's John channeling James.
Yep.
So GoldenEye came out when I was in high school. And actually, it came out at probably the perfect time for me in terms of age. I mean, by the time I got to college and lived in the dorm, we were playing Perfect Dark by then. Mm-hmm. And even that was, you know, it was almost behind the times. We were more interested in Smash Brothers Melee and stuff like that for the most part in the dorm. But, you know, we did play some Perfect Dark, but GoldenEye was high school times. And... that's really my first memory of playing multiplayer games with anyone but my sister. And I never enjoyed playing video games with my sister. She just didn't appreciate them the way I did.
Girls
so.
Suck.
Well, they do when your sister especially sucks when you're like, you know, 13, 14, 15.
Oh yeah, no, but, she's the arch demon.
Yeah, no, we get along much better now. So anyway, GoldenEye was the first memory I really have of playing multiplayer games competitively with friends. Because I had friends before that time, I had friends who were gamers, but we were mostly interested in like RPGs and stuff like that. They were games that we would watch each other play, but we didn't really play together very often.
Yeah.
And certainly nothing like GoldenEye. Nothing with that just addictive, wild, chaotic, competitive feel to it, you know. Nothing like that. And I'd even, by that time, maybe I had even played, I'd seen Quake online, had seen Doom, but those weren't really multiplayer games for me. So this was the first time, and it was a revelation. I mean, I thought it was one of the most fun things I had ever done.
Yep.
And I still do. I mean, at least in my memories of that are some of the most fun I've ever had. Playing
See, I guess
with
the
friends.
The equivalent for me would actually be Battlefield 1942.
Okay,
the exact same emotions.
But that was all online, though, right?
You could play locally. We would go over to like the LAN cafe and play it.
And this is similar. I mean, you know, it's nice to have your own screen, but I think playing 4-player GoldenEye on the N64 is basically like a LAN party.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, same feel. I mean, you're all sitting there screen looking in a LAN cafe anyway, so mm-hmm. Yeah.
Throwing proximity mines all over the cave walls and, you know, ducking through vents.
Like, yeah, sniping somebody from the other end where, like, you can't even, like, you can just see, like, their head is only a pixel. And you're just sitting there sniping. You can't even see what the hell you're shooting at. You're like, yeah, screw you. And the other person, you just, like, that's, like, one of the ultimate games for just, like, getting in your buddy's face and just be like, you suck.
I clearly remember that the Golden Gun is above the toilet. Am I right? Is it there?
We didn't play Golden Gun very much.
Yeah, because it is a one-hit kill thing, so yeah. It's not, you're not necessarily going to go with that because it kind of balances the game a little bit.
So let's talk a little about the gameplay innovations of GoldenEye. Certainly, before that, I had played Doom. I'd played Duke Nukem 3D and Duke Nukem 64, which was actually probably the literal first multiplayer first-person shooter that we played on N64. Because I had Turok, and I liked Turok, but the first Turok didn't have multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pre-GoldenEye. So when I remember reading the previews of GoldenEye and Nintendo Power, and I didn't really see what the big deal was because, you know, I'd already played Turok and I didn't really see what the big deal was. And I ended up, you know, I heard it was so good and so I rented it and I was in love with it pretty quickly. I think in the single player, the fact is GoldenEye had to have been one of the first shooters that had actual missions.
Yeah.
It wasn't get to the end and shoot all the demons in the face on the way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just survive. You're a secret agent. You have to go in there and you have to do these certain things. And there's a sort of an open level that you have to explore and find these different objectives and do it without getting killed and do them in sequence.
Did GoldenEye come out before Dark Forces? Because I know Dark Forces had a lot of that.
Dark Forces might have been out first.
Because I know Dark Forces had a lot of stuff like infiltrate the base and find this, switch this off. That also came out on the PlayStation, but, you know, crappy version.
Yeah. Dark Forces came out in 95.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So, certainly maybe the first good console one, but it was the first game I'd played that had a mission structure, and I found it to be really engrossing. You know, so immersive, because now I don't feel like a space marine. I feel like James Bond. I'm doing things that James Bond would do.
Mm-hmm.
And they even have the part where you're using your laser watch on the train. There's all this crazy stuff. And a lot of that stuff you'd never done before in any video game. And definitely not from the first person view. And that was groundbreaking. I mean, just really impressive stuff. A lot of it doesn't sound like a big deal now, but that's because, you know, a lot of those games are imitating, and learning from GoldenEye, because it brought that to the home console. I think the controls were a big deal too. You know, Turok was not the easiest thing to control.
Mm-mm.
You had to use those C buttons to move around, and you're aiming with a joystick. I mean, it was accurate because you have the 3D aiming with the analog stick, but it was tough, and it was full of these terrible jumping sections that were like,
yeah,
just
the jumping.
Ridiculous.
Jumping with the C buttons is that, you know, I think it makes more sense to have movement delegated to the C buttons, but not if you're going to put jumping as part of that task. So, yeah, that was a problem.
It really was bad design, the jumping stuff. Otherwise, Turok's a really good game, but GoldenEye didn't have jumping, and it put movement on the joystick, movement and turning on the joystick, and you could sort of strafe with the C buttons when you needed to.
Although, you could customize the controls, I think, pretty much however you liked.
I don't think you could do, I don't think you used Turok-style controls until Perfect Dark, though.
And you could, I think, is it GoldenEye Perfect Dark where you can plug in a second controller and have two analog sticks? One of them does that. Oh, both, possibly.
You're right. Oh, you're right.
And when this was proposed, I put in GoldenEye for a laugh, and the thing that cracked me up is that it had a widescreen mode, which,
yeah,
you know,
oh,
when
yeah.
you think, like, every Nintendo-developed game for the GameCube didn't have one.
Yeah. A Rare was way ahead on things.
Yeah,
like
it's
that.
Pretty funny.
You know, the nice thing about the way it controls, it's not all that precise, and the game was designed around that, so you didn't.
Yeah.
It had a lot of auto aim,
especially close in. The auto aim really kicks in then. If you're trying to take someone out from range, you know, you're not necessarily just going to be able to shoot and take them out, and so that's where you're going to hold the R shoulder button, get the crosshair up and try and do a precise hit. But close up, you know, because if you was using the C buttons, it would be so imprecise probably that you could miss people pretty easily, even if they are at close range. The auto aim's kind of crazy. It really takes over.
Yeah, but I mean...
But it does make it work.
Yeah, I mean, it always feels good, and you always feel powerful. But I think, especially in multiplayer, having the movement on the joystick made it so much more accessible than something like Turok, and it made the game play faster. It's a weird thing, but there's something about it where you can just sort of swivel around with that joystick that I think it actually makes the game feel faster paced than a lot of the other shooters around that time.
Mm-hmm.
And GoldenEye multiplayer it's really fast.
Yeah.
The pace of it is really, really fast, especially if you're on one of the smaller levels. And I think the controls are a big part of that. And, you know, on Perfect Dark, I think I probably usually play with Turok controls just because they're more accurate.
Mm.
I did a lot of the Farsight stuff, so you need to have good aiming for that. All right, let's talk about the presentation for a sec. The graphics... they were great at the time.
Yeah.
The draw distance was definitely a big upgrade on the first Turok.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what, the far?
I mean, it's still not great, but it's a massive improvement.
Seriously, I look at Turok now, and I just, I laugh my ass off. It is so ridiculous. Because the thing is, too, you know, I feel like a schmuck because... I sold myself on the fact that, oh, well, you're in a jungle, so it's fog, right? It's fog. No,
oh,
it's just crappy draw distance.
I played Turok when I was like 12, and I didn't go into that level of rationalization.
I was trying to make it better than it was in my mind.
I'm very disturbed that you were capable of doing that.
I was just like, I spent like so much money on this game, I was like, oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
Well, I will say for Turok, it probably did run smoother than GoldenEye did most of the time.
It did.
Not that either of them were that smooth, but...
Yeah, GoldenEye had some pretty awful frame rate stuff. I don't know that it's worse than Perfect Dark, but it's just as bad.
And obviously Perfect Dark is, the draw distance is somewhat better again. You know, there's more detail.
But also, it also used the expansion pack. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it needed it for everything but the barest of the multiplayer options. You needed the RAM pack.
Yeah, it was really weird. It was like it was almost like buying a PC game when you look at the back of the box on Perfect Dark, because it's, here's all the stuff you can do without the expansion pack. Here's all the stuff that you can do with it. You know, there's like checklists and everything.
Yeah.
It's weird to me that they allowed you to play it at all without the expansion pack.
Yeah, I guess it was just purely like for the most casual GoldenEye players. It's kind of like, well, the thing they liked about GoldenEye was just really simple death matches. So we'll give them that at least. And then maybe they'll think, oh, well, this is good, but we want to go out and get the expansion pack to actually play the game.
Right. But in other terms of presentation, I think the audio design is so great on GoldenEye. Not only the music, which is wonderful, and of course, John referenced it earlier, it has that little Bond riff that plays all the time.
Yeah, it uses the Monty Norman Bond theme, which, I mean, the thing is that in terms of like stuff from GoldenEye, the film, there really isn't a lot. You know, there isn't like the Tina Turner song melody or anything like that. Like, it's just the Bond theme just worked into a bunch of kind of original compositions for each stage.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of like Star Wars Rogue Squadron, the Factor 5 game, because it had very little original Star Wars music, but all the new stuff that they made sounded like Star Wars music. And I think I think Rare did a great job of that with GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Well, I think they did. Although when you go back to it now, this does kind of sound a bit like Bond filtered through banjo. You notice the similarities in the instrumentation with Rare's other games that weren't as apparent at the time. Perhaps.
Well, this was pre-banjo.
It was pre-banjo, yeah, so I hadn't played Kazooie when GoldenEye came out.
I mean, I think up to this point, the only other Rare N64 game was probably Blast Corps.
Yeah.
And that had an excellent soundtrack as well.
Really fun.
You know, it was such a completely different game. Rare had never made a shooter, really. Certainly not a first-person shooter. And so, we didn't really know what to expect.
The whole thing was really weird. I mean, I remember, obviously, GoldenEye, you know, the film came out in 95. You know, so when it came out, when GoldenEye for N64 came out in the holiday of 97, that's a really weird situation to have a license game. It was actually coming out alongside the next Brosnan Bond film, Tomorrow Never Dies.
Oh, yeah, that shitstorm.
This is kind of strange. Because it went through this whole period. Like, I'm sure at one point they were talking about it as a Super NES game. Yeah, at the very earliest stage. That it might be like a kind of run and gun-ish sort of thing with pre-rendered graphics. So I mean, it went from that to, you know, pretty quickly go to the N64. And, you know, it's the Rare have given the interviews with Edge recently, talking about how hectic and awkward that pull process was, and that, you know, it kind of went really to the wire in terms of a lot of the stuff that got done on the game did end up getting done very late in the process. So it was a real adventure getting this made. But I mean, as a movie tie-in, I think it achieved some landmark things despite not achieving the calendar synchronicity, because I mean, if you've seen GoldenEye, I mean, the locations, you know, are pretty faithful insofar as they can be. I mean, they kind of have to futz with the story and invent reasons why Bond would go to these places that he never went to in the film, or reprise certain settings for extra levels and stuff that wouldn't have happened in the film. But, you know, I mean, compared to some of the craziness, there was pretty much a standard for prior licensed games. I mean, just the fact that you had in the pre-ESRB era, you had movie tie-ins for Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, kind of shows you what movie tie-ins were like before.
Yeah, there's a lot of leniency back then, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, one part of the presentation that you don't hear about all that much, but I really appreciated, was the animation. Because GoldenEye was the first game I played where enemies would react differently based on what part of the body you hit them in.
Yep.
And of course, if you go back a couple of years to sprite-based first-person shooters like Doom and Wolfenstein, that's not possible. There's no segmentation there, you know. There's not really any animation either.
Yeah, there's just a couple of frames and, you know, and the, you know, the alien falls over like in Doom.
Yeah. And Turok had some good animations, but they were they were elaborate, but they were also really canned. I mean, there was some fun stuff, like if you shot certain enemies with a bow and arrow, like blood would spurt out of their neck and they would...
Yeah, it's big on the gore with T-Rock, obviously.
Oh, they're really funny, but in GoldenEye, it actually felt like they were more connected to how you were playing the game.
And you got the whole, like, building into, like, obviously the menu system was built into his gadget watch, and, you know, they tried a bunch of different things to tie it as much into a kind of Bond feel as they could. And yeah, I mean, they were, for the standards of the time, it was very, very successful in that, you said, just even going into the gameplay with the stealth elements and all that, it did feel like a James Bond product rather than just something with a Bond label on it.
Right. So in terms of multiplayer, I don't know how much focus that Rare had put on the multiplayer in this game. Certainly they put a ton of it in Perfect Dark, but
yeah.
With GoldenEye, I wonder if it was sort of an afterthought, and then like they realized very late that their office was totally addicted to it, and they tried to cram in a couple extra levels. And
well, there were even a couple they left out. Weren't there? There was at least one that was hidden that some people unlocked with Game Shark, didn't they?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Multiplayer, I don't remember when I first played it or what. All I remember is that I just almost immediately was just mesmerized by it. Just totally addicted. I thought it was the most fun thing I'd ever done. And multiple birthday parties. I mean, the funny thing is I never owned GoldenEye. Because, you know, like I said, I had some trepidation when it first came out. I didn't understand what all the big fuss was, so I rented it. And I ended up renting it probably, you know, several times over the years. where I should have just bought a copy, but I've never owned it, and so it became this ritual where I had this group of friends, and I don't know if any of us actually owned it, but anytime we had a birthday party or a sleepover or whatever, you know, any kind of let's get together, order a pizza, and play video games, we would rent GoldenEye every single time.
It's just such a great multiplayer game. I mean, it's one of the few games where the split screen. Where, I mean, it really, really works. I mean, even though like back then they had to do split screen, I think it really added to the whole experience, you know. Yeah. Whereas now it's like it's just kind of not the same because you can play stuff online and the online experience is generally better. And
yeah.
Back then it was split screen, but it was really, really good. Like I think it was the perfect point where the graphics weren't quite good enough to feel so much worse or slower in split screen. They just worked really, really well.
I wonder, John, if you think maybe part of the reason the split screen works so well is that the low level of detail in the environments makes it hard to tell where the other players are, even if you do look on their quadrant.
Yeah, to a certain degree. Yep, you would have to know each level really well.
I mean, I had the luxury of playing it on a pretty big TV at the time, like a 25-inch 4:3 TV. But, I mean, for a lot of younger people at the time, we're probably playing it on really tiny sets like that.
It was called the GX TV, you know, the one with, like, the doors that opened up and they were speakers. It was a TV made for video games. I bought this when I was a teenager, and I love that TV. It was pretty ridiculous, but it had a great sound. It was stereo, but still it was great sound. The only problem is the screen wasn't very big. It was 13 inches, and it made it hard to play stuff like GoldenEye.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, GoldenEye was a big deal for me. Because I did play, two players quite a lot of stuff back in the 16-bit era, especially sports stuff, Madden, FIFA, ISS that came later, Konami's, that was the sort of early stages of what we still have today with FIFA and Pro Evo. But with N64, it had four controller ports, of course, which is a big deal, but I didn't buy it on Mario Kart 64 because it got a bit of a negative kind of reaction in some of the British magazines that I used to read when it came out in Japan, because I think they didn't like some of the changes to Super Mario Kart, which was like treason. like the people in these magazines like must have played Super Mario Kart in lunch hours for like 4 years or something. And so when 64 comes along, they're like, this is bullshit. So, with the price of getting it, like, I passed. So GoldenEye was the first time that I ever had like four-player multiplayer with my school friends. I was 13 at the time. And that was it then. it became a fixture. Even when we wouldn't play GoldenEye, there was all the other great N64 multiplayer games that followed, particularly Smash Brothers, ultimately kind of killed GoldenEye.
Two years later, but...
Oh, yeah, we played so much GoldenEye in the interim. I mean, that was what got the ball rolling. It really established the idea of, like, you know, four people in the same room. This could just be an absolute riot, you know, fun on a level that you haven't had with multiplayer video games before. And I think a big part of that was the weapons, to be honest. I mean, just the amount of different ways you could kill people, you know, screwing around, bouncing grenades off walls.
Yeah. I was always a mines guy. Yeah. I love the mines.
And the fact that you could throw the mines and they would stick to the wall.
Yes.
I mean, it was just, it was fun to just deploy them. And the thing is, you could sit there and you could just wait for somebody to walk in. You know?
Yeah.
You could just, like, there was no end to the ways that you could be a dick to your friends in GoldenEye.
Yeah, though, the pathetic detail of the N64's graphics notwithstanding, a still screen in the quadrant will tip people off that you're up to something.
Exactly. And what I love, too, just like a total random thing, I loved it when you killed somebody, especially when you blew somebody up with the mines, and you watched it from far away, because you would see their, like, they go into, like, their death throes, like, they would, boom, yeah. And then they would just, like, slowly, like... like, do their whole slump over to the ground kind of thing. It was
like a really
stuff.
Slow sink to the floor, wasn't it?
Yep.
And more explosions there were, the more it would just chug to a halt. It would get... explosions in that game just killed it. Yep. Anything would just completely ruin it.
It was great for effect, though, because, you know, all of a sudden it's like you would just get the greatest kill on somebody. And then...
it's kind of like, you know, when you kill people in Street Fighter 2 or something, you know, it's just like, whoa! Yeah.
Exactly.
So I guess to compare it to, like, my sad alternate gaming reality, the first time, you know, the first console I owned was a GameCube. So the first time I had this experience at my house was also on a 13-inch screen, four players, Star Fox Assault.
Never had the pleasure.
If you'd said Star Fox 64, I'd have been like, okay, but
no.
Yeah, see, that I did have a Star Fox 64 that had four player multiplayer. That never.
Oh, we played
on.
That too.
I have played that, but God, yeah, I've played so much of the Star Fox Assault multiplayer.
Wow.
It's sad, and like my friends think about that in the same way that we're talking about GoldenEye right here.
Mm. Are you trying to impugn the quality of GoldenEye? Is that what you're trying
to... Sounds like. The first person I've ever heard compare that to Star Fox Assault, that's for sure. So, Nathan, I know you didn't play GoldenEye back in 97 like we did, but when you did finally play it, what were your thoughts? I mean,
I did play it at quite a young age over at a friend's house. I was like 9 or something. But then when I played it as an older gamer, like a couple of years ago, I literally just hurt my eyes and I stopped playing.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that. It's
my eyes actually hurt.
No, I mean, I popped it in today. I mean, it's just difficult to distinguish things. I mean, it's just a fact. That's how kind of crazy it was. But the multiplayer maps were generally compact enough, especially when you knew them, to make it work, despite that obvious limitation.
Right. And I think GoldenEye holds up actually surprisingly well today, other than the visuals. If you could just go in and swap out a bunch of models and textures and things, I think the game would be totally fun to play now.
Well, and for a long time, they were saying they were going to make that XBLA remake, and a lot of people were psyched about that.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
I actually would have picked that up, you know.
Yeah. It's basically what they did for Perfect Dark, they wanted to do to GoldenEye.
Yeah, it would have been incredible. But I think I mentioned it on the show, but about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, I actually played some GoldenEye 4-player on a giant wall projection screen. So it was like, if you can imagine blowing an N64 game up to over 100 inches of diagonal screen.
It must have been awful.
No, we had a blast. We played for over an hour, and I had a blast. I also kicked everyone's ass, but...
got the old magic.
I had an amazing time. I mean, yes, it looks absolutely shitty, and some of those multiplayer levels are a lot more complicated and confusing that I remembered. The temple in particular, because it has all those walls, those secret walls that come up and down, and
the doors,
I got
yeah.
so lost. Mm-hmm. I got so lost.
There's some samey kind of rooms in there, right? I mean, yeah. as I remember.
Yeah, it's hard to tell where you are, where you've been. But, I just had a wonderful time playing it. And it was almost not even split screen because each one of the quadrants was bigger than any TV I'd ever played GoldenEye on before. Yeah. So, you know, I think if you can sort of cross your eyes a little bit or, you know, just take your glasses off or
put a paper bag over its head.
Yeah. Oh, it's still so much fun. I didn't get to play the single player, but I would love to go back. My N64 is packed away somewhere. Like I said, I never even owned a copy, so I'd have to go pick one up. But
I mean, in terms of single player, I think what John and I spoke of at the beginning of this discussion in terms of the unforgiving nature of it.
Sure.
I mean, for instance, the way it works with the different difficulties, like you've got, you know, Agent, Special Agent 00 being the final hardest one, mm-hmm. is that it adds objectives in. And some of yep. these objectives can end up being like, I mean, I think at the second level, the facility one where you're going in and you end up blowing up the big tank's chemicals. Like mm-hmm. one of the objectives is you can't end up killing scientists or something. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could just be playing that level for a number of minutes that somehow they get, you know, collateral damage and it's like you fail that objective.
Yeah.
That's it.
Like there's stuff yeah. that's completely really out of your control.
Almost, yeah. So, I mean, I like the way they did it with the difficulties because certain parts of levels you might never see on certain difficulties.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Or, for instance, like I know this one level, I think it's like a weapons depot. On some difficulties, that is pretty much just a straight run.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You just shoot guys, you get to the end, that's it. And then on 00, you've got to go in these warehouses and blow up specific things, and it completely changes the way you play the level.
Yep.
I wish more games now did that, because, I mean, it really encourages you to play through the game multiple times and try these other difficulties.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, it did make statistical adjustments in terms of how much damage they would do to you. You know,
sure.
That meant that definitely the stealth element that's in the game was way more important on the 00. Because, you know, on Agent and Special Agent to a degree, you could sit there and take punishment and play pretty stupidly, and maybe you're going to get things done. Whereas 00, on a lot of missions, that wasn't going to cut it. I mean, I bet there's like the bunker one where you're escaping from prison.
Mm-hmm.
That's like super stealth, because if you get found out, they just pour and pour and pour in until you're out of ammo and you will die.
Yep.
Like, it's pretty much you have to play that stealthily.
Do you remember the feature, I think this was in GoldenEye, where, like, if you're holding down the R trigger to go into aiming mode, but then you use the C buttons, you can lean out from corners?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of like cover.
Yeah, exactly.
There was definitely some levels that leveraged that quite a lot, like the train level, which, you know, it's a straight corridor. It's, you know, there's none of that kind of openness to it. Like, I mean, you know, that's the thing. There was a lot of variety in the levels. You'd have like the snow level where, you know, it's really open. You just kind of go to a few little points
to do things.
But then you've got a train, which is, you know, kind of like, you know, the time you might, if there's almost like an old school, you know, corridor shoot a bit.
Mm-hmm. You start off on the dam.
Yeah, the dam was the first one, which, yeah, was kind of a bit of a mix of elements.
Yeah, the dam is a weird level.
Yeah.
But when you're in the train, especially on, like, the harder difficulties, you really need to lean out from all the boxes that are loaded onto this train.
Because it's all about line of sight, because you have these, yeah, I mean, like you said, it's a narrow corridor with a lot of obstacles and guys sort of standing behind them, so you kind of want to just creep out and just barely see him, shoot him, and then duck back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's great.
I mean, that kind of gunplay was way more sophisticated than Turok.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Turok was the only thing that I had played as an FPS for. I'd not touched Doom or anything like that.
Yeah.
So that feeling of like I said, gunplay rather than just shooting like monsters and crazy stuff was a completely different experience.
Yeah, I mean, even if the AI sucked, at least the level design helped it out enough that you felt like you were shooting people. You know, like.
Oh, definitely. But I mean, AI was kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, in some cases with the way the stealth stuff works, you know, if you shoot someone in a certain way, people will come after you if you shoot them in the right way, they won't. But then other times it's just weird, like you will shoot someone right next to someone else and they are completely oblivious to it.
Mm-hmm.
They had some kinks to work out.
Definitely. Especially like with the prolonged death animations, like you've been watching this guy die for 20 seconds and seem oddly unperturbed by it.
Oh man, we really gotta wrap it up now. Unless anybody has a final thought, they just have to get out there.
Star Fox Assault was an excellent game.
No. Yeah. No. All right. Well, that went on longer than I expected, but really, we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's GoldenEye is such a monumental game in the history of this medium, and I'm really excited to see how the remake sort of recollects some of these things without actually literally recreating them in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it, you know, what I'm looking for it is it for it to remind me of the original GoldenEye without actually being like a slavish.
Well, I mean, it could be something like Super Meat Boy, you know, that would, Super Meat Boy is entirely different from some of those old games we play. It's really fresh, but it definitely harkens back to them.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm pretty excited, and, you know, all the reviews have been really positive so far, and I certainly enjoyed what little I got to play of it at E3, and I enjoyed seeing the single-player demo. But the multiplayer, I'm definitely kind of excited to get people to come over and play it, because I think, you know, just the name alone means I'm going to be able to drag up a few people to sit around and play this. And the online mode sounds pretty interesting too, and I'll definitely check that out. But I think the single player, more than anything, I mean, I'm a single player gamer for the most part. So,
mm-hmm.
And I have very fond memories of GoldenEye single player. So I'm really curious to see how that pans out and how nostalgic I get.
As someone that's never really got into playing games online, to me, it's cool that you've got something here that's the split screen is being emphasized, because,
sure,
you know, of the primarily multiplayer wise, I play the local multiplayer stuff like Boom Blocks and Smash Brothers that doesn't have to deal with split screen.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's a price worth paying for, you know, that camaraderie and the joshing that goes on with people in the same room.
Oh, yeah. I, a lot of times I will just not buy a console multiplayer game, or, you know, I will not invest in the multiplayer if it's not split screen.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. I mean, it's especially,
yeah, for
I mean,
me.
Yeah, you really like to have both options.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially when a lot of times in a lot of games, there's no reason why they don't do it.
Well, because a lot of it's going to be like, well, you know, you got to do performance optimizations for how it's going to run a split screen. And yeah, with the target demographic, it doesn't really make sense because they don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, performance-wise, it's more difficult to do split-screen than it is online.
Mm. So, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it is, you know, an undertaking, and when it doesn't match with the product, really, or the audience you're trying to reach with the product, then I can see why they don't do it. But this is a weird sort of intersection of factors where, you know, it definitely makes sense, because that's probably the most profound sense in which it is actually recalling the original, is that this is split-screen multiplayer where we're putting some effort into it, and that's the selling point. So I'm intrigued to see that. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people who might have absolutely loved playing GoldenEye back in the day, for whom that is just, you know, because of their lifestyle, their circle of friends, whatever. It is not going to happen. And, you know, that's the way it is. But, I mean, they've got the online for a start, and then for everyone else, it could be a really nice throwback. So it's on the radar.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up the GoldenEye discussion for this week. So now we move on to listener mail, and we've just got a couple of quick questions here. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Nathan, could you read the first letter for us, please?
Sure. Austin, a.k.a. Brood Wars from Orlando, writes, "I'm finding myself increasingly irritated with Nintendo as the Wii generation goes on, as they continue to create and heavily market peripherals that they then go on to barely, if at all, support. Aside from Zelda, Wii Sports Resort, Zangeki in Japan, and Flink Smash, Nintendo's barely supported the Motion Plus, and I can't remember the last Nintendo title since Brawl that actually supported the classic controller outside of the Virtual Console or WiiWare. Now I'm reading impressions for Donkey Kong Country Returns, and once again there's no classic controller support. If you want to play the game, you have to put up with Nintendo's completely frickin' arbitrary motion control nonsense. If there was any game that you would think would support the classic controller, that would be DKCR. Is there any reason why we should ever purchase a Nintendo peripheral when Nintendo themselves rarely ever have any interest in actually allowing us to use them for more than a couple of titles over the course of a console's life cycle?"
Purchase the game that it's bundled with. And after that, good luck.
Yeah, weigh it up in your mind, is that game worth it?
Yeah.
Because that's pretty much how Nintendo does it. That's their more economic approach to these sorts of things. They're not like, oh, this is going to pay off in the long run because we're going to support it with a whole bunch of stuff. It's like this, yeah, the balance board is for Wii Fit. And that's it. It's justified on those grounds. Yeah.
Although I guess for core gamers, there's always been the dangling fruit of Zelda for the Motion Plus.
Yeah.
True. But, I mean, the Motion Plus is not completely contained to just Wii Sports, but I mean, for me, it probably was worth it to buy it just for Wii Sports Resort. I've had a lot of fun with that game.
Yeah.
But also Tiger as well, you know, was a big part of that. So Motion Plus is, you know, yeah, it's pretty weak, but it's not literally been one game, but maybe that is the safest policy is just don't sort of convince yourself on the basis that there's going to be this hypothetical stream of support titles in the future, because Nintendo does not have that mindset.
Yeah.
I don't think they think ahead that far.
Yeah. I mean, they'll look to third parties to kind of fill it out if they want
Maybe.
Allow me to point you to like stuff like the e-reader, the Game Boy camera.
It's not just Nintendo. I mean, think about like the Xbox Live Vision camera. The original iToy was just a joke, really. Yeah.
Well, especially the way it was supported in America. I mean, Sony of Europe got on the whole casual thing a lot more aggressively than their other regional counterparts. So they had more support for the iToy. They did more with stuff like SingStar. But yeah, in America, I mean, it was not robust, was it?
I'm not sure if it's reasonable to expect that stuff like the Game Boy camera would have supported other games.
Perfect Dark.
Really?
There was the famous thing that they had this face mapping plan.
Yes.
That got nixed because you'd be shooting your friends.
Yep.
Oh, see, all I remember was being pissed that I was out of printer paper. completely screwed.
Yeah.
At least you could never run out of ink.
True.
It was heat-based printer.
I liked making the little shoot 'em up game in there. That was fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think I'm aligned with Brood Wars in the sense that what actually bothers me is not so much when a peripheral comes out and only two or three games support it. I can live with that. I mean, as we've talked about with like Motion Plus, I'm fine with that as long as the games that support it work well. And, you know, I think I'm with Greg. I think Resort alone sort of justifies the existence of that thing. What bothers me is when other games come after that could have used it and could have benefited from it and don't.
Mm-hmm.
That's what pisses me off. And I think it speaks to the Donkey Kong situation with Classic Controller, where there have to be millions of Classic Controllers out there. And from what we've seen and read and played of Donkey Kong Country Returns, there's really no reason that you have to use the motion control.
I think the weirdest thing about that is that Donkey Kong Country, the original, was a Super NES game. It's a four-button controller game.
Yeah.
So in terms of the whole, like, Metroid Other M is like a new generation Famicom game, or New Super Mario Brothers is like playing Super Mario Brothers on the NES or the Famicom. It's like I could see that they kind of wanted to put the hard sell on using it NES style, or Punch Out as well, which had a motion setup and then the NES setup. But, you know, they're trying to trade off a very specific NES nostalgia because of the franchises and probably because of the particular kind of lapsed gamers that they're trying to reach out to. When you go to DKC, that's different. So why the hell you wouldn't have a classic controller, which looks a lot like a Super NES pad? If you're in Club Nintendo in Europe and Japan, you can have a classic controller that looks like a Super NES pad.
Well, what's even weirder too is that they released, you know, Monster Hunter Tri with the Classic Controller Pro. But then you have all these games coming out that don't even use the classic controller at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go back to, like, one example that's very shortly after Brawl that uses classic controller from Nintendo, but it's even more mainstream than Brawl, is Mario Kart Wii. I mean, you've got the wheel option, you've got the nunchuck and remote option, but you've also got classic controller and GameCube controller support.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that didn't scare anyone. I mean, as I said, it's difficult to justify it in this case, to me, because you've got two functions as well, haven't you? Like, that are designated in the control schemes to some sort of motion. You've got the roll thing, which is definitely an issue, because what happens is you roll with DK, you do that kind of roll attack, but you can also jump out of it and get more distance, which is really pronounced in the new game. It was there before, but it's really pronounced now. And that's got an element of timing that kind of worries me. But then you've also got this kind of thing where DK blows into the scenery and so you can uncover secrets and all that. So you end up with like having to do a motion while holding a direction on the analog stick or on the D-pad, depending which configuration you're using. So it's getting really convoluted at that point. Why not have the classic controller there? It's, you know, justifiably frustrating, I feel.
As an option. I think, honestly, it comes down to Nintendo trying to push an agenda. You know, they know that there are a lot of people out there who have a Wii and don't play it that often. And I think when they get those people to come back and play Wii with a big nostalgic game like Donkey Kong Country Returns, they want to remind you of what makes Wii special. And I think they're pushing an agenda here. And now, with games like New Super Mario Wii and Kirby's Epic Yarn, it's kind of justifiable because there are gameplay elements in both of those games that could only be done with motion control. They might be minor, but there are points in those games that you get to and you have to have a Wii remote in your hand in order to do it. With Donkey Kong Country Returns, nothing we've seen so far is that way. It's waggle. It's being used to replace functions that could be done with a button. And in that case, if Nintendo is really pushing it, because I mean, we've told Retro, everybody from E3 told Retro, you're going to have like a non-motion option here, right? Everybody told them that. And if they still haven't put it in there, and we still haven't seen any evidence that there's some kind of tilty platform, or there's a part where you have to point at the screen and do something, that tells me that Nintendo is like forcing an agenda on them.
Yeah, it's by diktat. Yeah, it would definitely be from high with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a perception thing, ultimately factoring into kind of marketing and all that kind of stuff, over what's functional. And yeah. You know, no one's ever going to be happy about that. Do I expect it to, you know, really severely compromise my enjoyment of the game, you know, the sort of timing issues I mentioned notwithstanding? No. I mean, I imagine I could deal with it.
I think it could. I mean, given how difficult Donkey Kong Country Returns appears to be and how the roll is so timing-based and how it's so integral to the platforming in this game, it could be a deal breaker for me.
I don't know. I mean, Aaron, in his impressions for our website, he very much preferred using it NES style rather than with the nunchuck. He felt like that actually made it click for him.
You have to use motion either way.
You have to use motion either way, but in that setting with the D-pad instead of the analog stick, which, you know, again, leaves things to be desired on the remote that it doesn't on the classic controller, but, you know, but he felt that it worked well enough, and he played a lot of the game, and you have tough bits of it.
Sure.
I was actually repulsed with myself, like, a while back. I was playing Super Mario 3 on Virtual Console, and I was jumping over a gap, and I shook the Wii remote.
That's kind of infectious.
It is. That sinks in. You know, everything else I'm fine switching off.
It's a nice little finessing move. That's the thing. Yeah. I'm fine with that kind of thing being used to finesse things, to fudge things a bit. But when it's integral to the gameplay,
right?
It's like Galaxy's kind of pushing it. I've never really had a problem with that. But there's certain things in Galaxy 2 that are...
Galaxy pushes it, yeah.
But this could break it. It could. I mean, I don't know yet.
Yeah.
It's a danger.
And the sad thing is just so damn needless, you know, it's so damn needless. Unless there's like a secret world that's all about pointing the screen that no one's been able to talk about.
And, you know, and the thing is, I mean, you always have a Wii remote, even when you're using the classic controller. So why not just let me play the whole game with classic controller? I get to this one place where I need to point or do a gesture, and it tells me, pick up the Wii remote, jackass, and do, you know.
Yeah, doesn't Monster Hunter do some sort of pointing when the classic controller's plugged in for so? I think it gets ridiculed for being really rubbish, but it is possible to do it.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, you do that when you scan monsters. It's fine. It's not a big deal. I mean, you just pick up your Wii remote and scan the monster and just move on. I mean, you don't do it very often, so.
It is, I'd say there is a very slim but real possibility that there might actually be a non-motion or a classic controller option buried in the options somewhere that they just haven't shown yet. Do you remember when they were demoing Punch-Out for Wii, and they made everybody at the demos, they made everybody use the motion control? When it came out, everybody, you know, used the buttons, of course. So it's possible.
It's possible from the point of view that, as we said, the whole reason for them, you know, if we're going to say they have enforced the absence of classic controller support, the whole reason for doing that is some sort of perceptions thing. Mm-hmm. But if you're so concerned with perception, it's also plausible that you might have the option in there, but kind of pretend it doesn't exist.
Exactly. Well, you think they'd want to kind of support that to fuel hardware sales from the, or, you know, controller sales from the hardcore gamers, you know? Yeah. I hate saying hardcore, but I would easily buy a class controller if I hadn't already had one to use that for DKCR.
Who knows? Who knows? All right, Greg.
Okay, so the next letter is from Danny McL in England, and he writes, "Hey guys, I want to know if you can dedicate a bit of your RFM podcast to the subject of The Sims 3. A lot of websites such as IGN, who are a tad shit..."
It sounds so right when you say it, Greg.
Well, it's the mother tongue. What can I say? The queen is grinning with pride somewhere. Aren't covering it in much detail in their podcast. They mention the name, and that was it. So it would make you quite damn cool if you did dedicate 2 to 4 of the 108 minutes you have in the show to it. I'll decide how many minutes are in this show.
It's frightening because we're like 2 minutes away from 108 minutes right now.
I'm watching the trailer right now, by the way.
P.S. Do you have any information on a new Need for Speed for Wii and DS? Because I can't find anything on the interweb.
Smiley face.
First off, about Need for Speed, there's no announcement of anything for Wii or DS. Of course, the new Need for Speed this year is Hot Pursuit. Yep. And that's developed by Criterion, the Burnout guys in England, actually. And I just played the demo for it today on my 360, and it seems really fun. It seems like maybe it goes back to the old Burnout games, where it's all sort of point-to-point racing and fairly linear track designs. There's a couple shortcuts and swerve-off points, but it's not like the open-world thing like Paradise, where you had to worry about turn left here, turn right here, etc. It seems really fun. It's definitely beautiful. It would feel exactly like a new Burnout, and I'd be a lot more excited for it, except that it uses licensed cars, which means the damage from the crashes is pretty minor, and it seems to lack a little bit of the attitude and the sort of the independent spirit of Burnout, you know, where they don't have to worry about that stuff. Burnout's a little bit crazier.
Yeah.
And the new Need for Speed seems a little more classy, a little more sophisticated, but it definitely has a very strong Burnout feel, and the boost mechanic works the same way, where you get a boost for driving like an asshole. And if you're playing as the cop, basically the goal of the races, as far as I can tell, is to knock all the racers off the road. So it's using the takedown mechanic, which is my favorite part from the last few Burnout games. So I'm definitely looking forward to that game, but it's not coming out on Wii or DS. And the sad thing is Criterion hasn't made a Wii game. They haven't made a game for Nintendo console since Burnout 2, which was like 2004, maybe 2003 or 2004. So it's been a long time, and I hope that changes sometime. They're one of my favorite developers, and I miss them on Nintendo systems. I mean, Burnout 2 for GameCube was probably the best version of that game, and unfortunately, that was the end of it for whatever reason. Acclaim published it back then, if you can imagine.
Wow.
Acclaim. It was like the only good thing Acclaim was putting out at that time. Of course, then they were purchased by EA, and EA certainly is within their power to make Wii games, but of course, Need for Speed is a different matter. This is the first time Criterion's done Need for Speed. So before that, it's been made by all kinds of different people. And there was a Need for Speed game out last year on Wii called Nitro. Mm-hmm. And people seem to like it generally. I played a demo back at E3 last year and didn't care for it at all. But the final version got pretty good reviews. So if you haven't played that yet, certainly go back and check that out. There's a DS version as well. I don't know how good that is. Need for Speed might come back to Wii next year, but if it comes back, it'll probably be like last year. It was completely different from the HD versions. Just a completely different game, period. Different name, different developer, different style. Everything about it was totally different. So The Sims 3. Who's played The Sims or The Sims 3?
My wife has played The Sims.
I have played The Sims, not Sims 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've not played Sims 3.
Oh, no. You know what? I played Sims 3 on the iPhone. Oh. That doesn't count.
No.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, the problem I always had with Sims 3, with The Sims in general, is that after a while you just kind of run out of stuff to do after you've kind of watched all the weird stuff. And I think, if I remember correctly, my wife actually stopped playing when she got so bored that she got like a repairman to the house, and she found like some glitch online where you could create walls around him to wall him into the bathroom.
That's not a glitch. That's the game.
Oh, no. Yeah, that has always been an integral part of The Sims, walling people in and watching them die.
Yeah, I don't think she could actually kill him, though. So that was kind of disappointing. I don't think she
actually... She probably just lost patience.
She may not have waited long enough.
Yeah. So that was kind of where she stopped.
Yeah, I watched actually Giant Bomb put up an hour long quick look of The Sims 3.
Hour long quick look. That is brilliant.
Yes. I thought it was kind of inscrutable. I just the interface definitely looks pretty insane. Even on the console,
there are so many menial tasks that you have to take part in, and it like you are babysitting this virtual character, and
it doesn't seem fun to me, you know.
No.
But apparently, everybody who plays it can't put it down.
I don't understand that. Then again, I got really into Animal Crossing, and I was like a fruit baron, you know. So I don't know. Maybe there is something in there.
But The Sims is so much more complicated than Animal Crossing.
Well, for me, they kind of got to the whole, you know, Facebook game gold mine before, like years before everybody else did, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, they just kind of figured that out, whereas Facebook, they just eventually got so much critical mass that everybody was on Facebook, so everybody saw, you know, the Farmville kind of games and all that, and they just started playing them. But anybody that had a PC who wasn't, you know, into like RTS games or whatever, probably got into The Sims.
Yeah.
Those kinds of people if they had just come online on Facebook, they're playing Farmville or Mafia Wars. Back then, they would have been playing The Sims.
Yeah, I wonder if that's eaten into the sales of Sims 3 on the PC.
I don't know.
It may have, because the people that want to play that sort of casual experience probably are looking elsewhere now, like John said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think it also has a big market with, like, sadistic teenage boys, because I remember playing that in conjunction with games like Roller Coaster Tycoon, in which we would make, like, the panda mascots slide down a hill into a pond and drown, you know, just stuff like that.
Yep.
Just messing with the limits of the game to eventually get a character to die. That was fun. Hours of fun.
Yeah.
Or making, you know, a roller coaster that shot off into nothingness. Just stuff like that.
I've never really played any of The Sims. It's never appealed to me, and I've talked to people who really like it. My sister actually called me a week ago and says, "Hey, what do you know about The Sims 3 for Wii? I'm thinking about, you know, picking that up or trying to ask for it for Christmas." And I said, "Honestly, I don't know a thing about it." And so it's funny that this question came out a couple days later. And I did some research. I found out, first off, the Xbox and PS3 versions are already out. They came out in October, actually. The Wii version's not out till like November 15th, at least in the U.S. I don't know about in England. But I don't know why the Wii version's taking longer. Maybe they had some trouble with it or something.
They're having trouble porting the iPhone version, probably.
Well, actually, the big thing about The Sims 3 for consoles is that it's supposed to be content-wise equal to the PC version.
Really?
They had to rejigger the interface a lot, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically the same game.
I wonder if they had to make so many interface changes for the Wii. It doesn't seem like you'd have to.
Yeah, but at the same time, the Wii has such a lower resolution that
You're right.
All those menus and tiny little things, it's going to be difficult to present it on Wii.
You're right.
But interface-wise, it should be more straightforward from the PC version. But I guess with Sims 1 and Sims 2, they did a lot of gameplay conversion for the console versions where they tried to make it play more like a console game, and people didn't like that. So for Sims 3, it's pretty much the PC game with different controls. And they're hoping that will appeal more to people. Watching that quick look over at Giant Bomb, I didn't really understand what the game was supposed to be about or why you would want to play it. It looked really, number one, really aimless.
Yeah, it seems so open-ended that it's pointless.
Yeah, like no overarching goals, and yet so many micro goals that it was overwhelming. Like, it's constantly bringing up meters and little quests and little things for you to do that your sim wants to do this, he wants to do this, he want, you know, and these things all seem like really tedious to actually accomplish. And yet in the overall, I don't really know what you get out of it. And then the other thing is, it just seems endlessly complex. Mind-boggling how many menus and how many different things you have to keep track of.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because I don't know how you can say something is pointless but yet incredibly complex. It's just a really weird combination. Like, you would think that normally something is so overwhelmed, has so many goals, that it's so complex. You know, usually a high degree of complexity goes along with multiple goals, but this is not the case with The Sims. It just seems like they've made something so simple unnecessarily complex.
That's kind of how I felt about watching it. And I mean, those guys were enjoying it because they were sort of griefing the AI characters, which is what Nathan was talking about. I mean,
right.
I spent 30-40 minutes trying to kill off the character by putting him in a wall where, you know, and he pees on himself and he can't get out. And there's a window where all the passersby go by and wave at him while he's in there starving. And
yeah, like, I certainly fast-forwarded through the quick look. I was not going to watch a sim pee itself and pass out in its urine for 30 minutes.
Right.
Just, yeah.
As funny as it sounds, it's not an entertaining thing to watch.
It's funnier when you say it rather than you experience it.
Exactly. It's just like in real life, you know? Like, the dude totally barfed all over and then he peed himself. Real life, you're cleaning everything up. It's not fun.
Well, you can tell that the thing that kept it entertaining for them, and I think the reason that a lot of people have watched that video and have enjoyed it, is because these guys are like, you know, the Sims don't actually talk. So they're doing the voices for the Sims. They're making up their own dialogue. They're basically, I mean, they're basically writing their own story as they go to explain the insane events that are taking place in the game.
Yeah.
So it seems like the kind of game where you make your own fun. Like, it's, you apply your own imagination to it and you fill in all those blanks and you almost create your own story. And I've seen EA market it that way too at press conferences. So I get that, but it doesn't appeal to me at all. I mean, I don't have an imagination. That's why I play video games.
And that's great if you have a friend that wants to come over and play pretend in The Sims with you, but really...
Yeah.
Well, I think the Wii version has not got a lot of coverage at all, as far as I'm aware.
Well, it's not out yet.
Yeah, obviously it's not even out yet, but that's part of it. But even in the lead-up, it's not that well publicized. But I think I read somewhere that one of the features that's different for the Wii is they've got a kind of what's pretty common on the Wii, you know, kind of a co-starry kind of mode. So I think someone could pick up another Wii remote and they have like a, you know, some sort of icon character that they can use to mess around with the other character, you know, going into that kind of griefing thing again. So
well, yeah, it would be cool if the other player could be like a ghost and knock shit over to scare the Sim or something, but
I can see that being fun. It's not for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the first time I ever heard about Harvest Moon. I couldn't fathom why anyone would play that. And I think when I finally did play Harvest Moon, I kind of got it. I mean, I get the, you know, the OCD aspect of taking care of the stuff and nurturing it. But for me, the only interesting part, and I played the GameCube one, at least the first one.
They're all
the
same.
And the only interesting part of that game for me was the overarching RPG aspect of it, where you're trying to get a wife and you're trying to build a house and you're trying to do these like really larger goals. And I did like the minimum amount of farming necessary to make progress on those larger things. The farming itself wasn't compelling to me at all. And I think the problem with The Sims is that it seems like that's all there is you farm your person.
You can sort of build your own story in The Sims 3 like that, but I guess the difference with Harvest Moon is that it lays it out for you. Like, you're choosing between options as opposed to making these options.
Yeah.
You know, like, instead of trying to hit on the pizza guy, you're, you know, pursuing, like, a set, like, I can pick farmer girl, I can pick neighbor girl, I can pick, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Okay, well, we talked more than 2 to 4 minutes about The Sims 3, so I hope that scratched the itch there. And certainly don't want to put down the game. It doesn't appeal to me very much, but it's an interesting case, I think.
Its appeal is certainly a curiosity for me.
Yeah, it's a weird phenomenon in gaming, The Sims,
because
it is astronomically successful on the PC.
Yep.
But I still don't get it.
Yeah.
I still don't really want
and
to play
honestly,
it,
but... I'll be honest, that kind of bothers me. You know? As a so-called quote-unquote expert, it kind of bothers me that I don't understand it.
Okay, well, we're going to have to end the show there.
Bye.
So, thanks to everybody who wrote in. Again, the address for sending in your listener mail is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And I really do enjoy these sort of out-of-the-blue questions. You know, ask us to talk about a game we haven't talked about or whatever.
Or know
or
about.
Tell us about a game that we haven't talked about, you know. I enjoy that. So... we have some announcements to make. First off, the retroactive poll has closed, and the Nintendo DS game that we will be playing next time, probably in 2 to 3 weeks on the show, is The World Ends With You, a Square Enix modern RPG that apparently involves like using fight. I think you fight on both screens at the same time, one with the buttons and one with the stylus. It sounds confusing and crazy. So definitely a very interesting game. I've never played it. Looking forward to trying that out. So the second place was Hotel Dusk, and that will go into our second chance poll, which will be the next time we do retroactive, maybe in a month or two. So thanks to everybody who voted, and if you haven't already got a copy of The World Ends With You, you might want to go pick that up. I think you can get one for pretty cheap if you look around. And play along. We'll have a forum thread open by the time you hear this, and you can post your thoughts in there, and we will be too. So, of course, you can also leave a review for us on iTunes, little star rating, and write a quick little review. We'd really appreciate that. It does help people find the show. It actually helps quite a bit in that respect. You can like us on Facebook and follow our weekly status updates. The address for that is facebook.com/radiofreenintendo. The talkback thread for these articles, I don't know how many people are aware of this. If you don't hang around on our website a whole lot, and if you're not already in the forums, you might not realize this, but every episode of the show has an article that I write, and it goes up on the site. And then there's a forum thread that is generated for that, and it always has lots of comments, really interesting feedback on the specific episodes. Most of us, I think all four of us, will post in those and kind of follow up on things that we might have said on the show. So that's another way to keep up with us and find out maybe a little behind the scenes or just a little bit of follow-up in between episodes. So you can check that out. Now, Nathan, as our special guest... would you like to plug your show?
Okay, yeah. I frequently, I guess, appear on an iPhone podcast, TouchGen Unleashed. It's kind of crappy. And then I appear on... it's actually popular. and then I appear on the Refined Newscast, which is sort of the little sister podcast to RFN. Every other week, Nintendo News.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't talk about news much on this show, so that's where you go to get your... podcast news analysis of all the Nintendo news.
We will dredge through the announcements and the downloads for you, so you don't have to.
Oh, yes. That's a good time, too. And actually, Nathan is going to be appearing on a couple of upcoming episodes of one of my side projects, Discover Music Project, over at Crosstalk. And we did two shows, one about death metal.
I'm scared for the world.
It's turned out to be pretty interesting. And then followed that up with my selection of Umphrey's McGee, which is a band that I doubt anyone listening to this has ever heard of.
But a lot more normal than the death metal episode, so.
Yeah, they're still a weird band, but they're really, really good, and nobody's ever heard of them, so perfect for that show. And actually, before that, that's might be a month away before you hear those, because I'm kind of behind. I'm not behind on editing. I'm ahead on recording. That's the best way to put it. Actually, the next episodes and the first one of these should be going up around the same time as this episode, maybe within a couple of days, is going to be with Andy Gergen, also from the newscast. And we are going to talk about Ben Folds and then follow that up with Bob Dylan. So those are really good, too.
Got to get the rest of the newscast on there. Zach for the Taylor Swift episode.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Zach or Neil's musical interest. I really haven't been proposing these to people. I'm just letting people come to me with their ideas because I want it to be something that they're passionate about.
Yeah, Neil enjoys the soundtrack to Jersey Shore, whereas Zach will
Yeah. I don't know if we could do that. I do want to get John on to do some hip hop.
Okay.
For sure.
Yeah. I'll gladly do that.
That's got to happen eventually.
I'll help you fight the power, Johnny.
I'd like to hear that played backwards over the death metal episode and see if the internet breaks.
So anyway, check that out. You can search for it on iTunes. So actually, search for Crosstalk with a W, and that's the easiest way to find it. Or go to crosstalk.com. Finally, James will, of course, be back next week. I will not. I'm quitting the show for 1 week. Next week, I have to defend my PhD dissertation. So the night before, instead of recording RFN, I might practice my presentation, my defense, or just maybe try to go to sleep
early. Picture something like Jean-Claude Van Damme training in Bloodsport.
It'll be a montage. Yes.
So he's in front of the radiator with his legs completely apart, with his forearms sort of
splits
coming
on
out.
The logs.
Yeah, that's, you know it. And I fully anticipate next week that we'll be in the middle of the show and Johnny will come on Skype and try and get on the call and we're going to have to say, no, do your work.
I need you to be strong for me. Because,
yes.
I'm very addicted to doing this.
I will tell you when you've had enough.
Yes. No, I'm going to take the week off just to help me focus and rest for the big day the next morning. And then the next time you hear from me, I will be Dr. Johnny. And I'll be the same.
You'll finally be able to differentiate the Johns now. You'll just be Doc.
Doc.
Oh,
and I could call John Johnny just to confuse everyone.
So when will you actually find out? Like
right after. I'll post on Facebook. Actually, if and when I pass, I have some character art from David O. to go up on Facebook.
Oh, you've been holding
the...
it that long. There was me thinking you were like, the hair's kind of wrong on this one. Can you send me another version?
The first one he drew, I had a beard, and I was like, I mean, I might be lazy about shaving, but I don't really wear a beard, so...
No, you never have.
He fixed it up a little.
And then it's like, well, this one's not rugged enough. And then the next one was like, oh, it's a bit feminine now.
My pecs aren't defined properly. No, I've got it. It refers to me as Dr. Johnny, so I'm waiting until that's official before I put it up there. But
it also has a much stronger jaw than the previous version.
He is a talented
My jaw is much squarer than that.
If you haven't seen John's eating poutine, I think, in that one.
Yeah, I'm more like a warrior of the frozen north, I believe, I think.
I think James looks like a caricature of Beaver, so perhaps a shockingly accurate.
A.K.A. the Beave.
Oh, James is cringing as he listens to this. All right,
I'm sure.
he can redress the sins committed upon him when he comes back next week. So with that, our show will end. And once again, I thank Nathan for coming in and doing this.
Dude, thank you for having me on. RFN has long been my favorite podcast. So it was like I was a child and Santa invited me to help him deliver gifts without all the implications of pedophilia, I guess.
And that's why we asked him to be on the show. All right, folks. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Have you been to one of the gas stations where they play the sonic ring noise at the checkout?
Oh my god, it's
so
weird.
I always
flip
out.
Yeah, it's really weird cuz you're not thinking about anything remotely related to video games at the moment.
No.
You're like, I want to buy this pack of Reese's Pieces.
Yes.
And they ring it up and it goes ding. It's the exact sound effect of Sonic getting a ring.
It's the exact one, and I just
it's
find myself
so evocative.
Clutching my wallet and just looking about. Just...
And then you run out really fast.
And then I hit a wall and fall into some spikes. And, damn it.
This, like Super Meat Boy, this is another game that I've actually found to be sort of physically painful to play after a while.
Really?
Well, partly it's the way I had the control set up. Because for a long time, I wanted the mark button and the destroy button to be on separate fingers so I wouldn't ever confuse them. And so I set breaking the blocks to be on the L trigger, which means I have to, like, you know, hold this thing in the claw like Metroid Prime Hunters.
Yeah,
I was
going to ask, like, more or less painful than Hunters.
It's the same level, except you're playing it for much longer.
I had, like, a pencil, and I would play with my mouth with Hunters.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Actually, in high school, I would bet people that I could beat them, like, using a popsicle stick in my mouth. And I totally would. And it hurt my eyes like crazy, but my hands didn't hurt.
Wow.
You have to see the Hulk Hogan Def Jam Rap Star video. It is, oh my God, it's incredible. It's, let me put it this way. It is funnier than Macho Man Randy Savage's rap album, in which the lead single of which, called Be a Man Hulk, I have on my iPod right now.
Yeah, I'm sure, as James would say, there are no words.
Yeah, there are words. They are all expletives.
One of the lyrics has Macho Man claiming that he landed a starring role in Spider-Man. He's in that movie for about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So
him and Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, exactly.
Terrible.